Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Craig
and Matt
Allen.
Matt, really looking forward to the card that we have coming up this weekend, UFC 256 from the UFC's Apex facility in Las Vegas, Nevada. Matt, they spent $100 million on that facility, and they're paying for it with fights like this. And Matt, you're not going to get me more excited for a card than the one that we have coming up this weekend. We've been calling for Brandon Moreno to get his due and to get his shot at the flyweight division's elite. And he's taking on Deiveson Figueiredo, a guy who's on a short list for Fighter of the Year. This guy is certainly a deserving candidate. I mean, the two wins over Joe B and then the absolute beatdown that he put on Alex Perez just a couple of weeks ago, really cementing his case. But a win over Brandon Moreno would really win him over in the eyes of a lot of the fans. And I know there's a lot of you out there. There's a lot of people in the media. They're down on the flyweights, but the Allen boys are not. So, Matt, Deiveson Figueiredo, Brandon Moreno at the top of this billing. But I know that you're excited for the co-main event that we have coming up.
Tony Ferguson's about to fight Charles Oliveira, and I don't think enough people are excited about it. I really don't. Honestly, this is the fight that I'm looking forward to more than the main event. And I don't mean that in any disrespect towards Deiveson Figueiredo or Brandon Moreno. I love both those guys. But I think this fight is so important for the lightweight division, because if Tony Ferguson can beat Charles Oliveira, he's one of the few guys who I think can tempt Khabib back into the sport. Whereas if Charles Oliveira wins, this is all he's needed for the last, well, for the past few years. He's just needed that one big name opponent that he can go out there and beat and really get his name in those title conversations. If you go out there and beat Tony Ferguson, yes, you got beat by Gaethje, but if you beat Ferguson, a title shot's next, or Connor's next, or Poirier's next. You only get great fights from there on out, so I think that fight's going to be phenomenal. It is an amazing card. It might not have the name value that a lot of other cards have, but I think excitement-wise, this will rival any card.
I mean, Matt, just looking at this card top to bottom, Moicano, Fazeev, we've got Kevin Holland in the rebooking, taking on Jacare Souza, Junior Dos Santos, Cyril Gane, Cub Swanson taking on Daniel Pineda. And I mean, Matt, on the undercard, who could forget Billy Quarantillo, Billy Q taking on the Maritime Zone, Gavin Tucker. That should be a great one. Carl Roberson taking on Dalcha, Lunjambula, Dalcha Champ from EFC. And again, there's some fights. Are they on this one? Are they not? There's going to be fights that fall out this week, Matt. That much is true. But overall, we have a really good card ahead of us. So, Matt, let's flip it over to our fight of the night screen, where we can talk about the fight that, I mean, this is going to grab all of the headlines. So we're looking at our fight of the night screen. And Matt, if you're new with Fight Night Picks, A, thanks for joining us. But B, on the fight of the night screen, we have to say, presented by Manscaped, make sure you check out our presenting sponsor, Manscaped. Use promo code FNP to get 20% off and free shipping on your order. And we'll talk a little bit about Manscaped as we go along through the show. But Matt, we normally have two fight of the night picks here. We're only going with one. The co-main event between Tony Ferguson and Charles Oliveira is an absolute barn burner. Charles Oliveira holds the UFC submission record, and the guy just continues to rack up finish after finish. Now, the knock against Charles Oliveira, and I know that we're going to talk about it later on when we really focus in on this co-main event, is the fact that his level of competition really hasn't been there with a lot of the guys in this division that are ranked. And if we go through his last five wins, Jim Miller, David Taymor, Nick Lentz, the Carney, Jared Gordon, and then in his last fight, Kevin Lee. And again, that's the fight that really, A, won him over with the rankings panel, but B, with the fans, the fact that he was able to do that as the world was closing in Brazil, a huge win for Del Bronx, Charles Oliveira, that we've known and loved in the UFC for a very long time. And with Tony Ferguson, the win streak that he was on before his last fight was absolutely amazing. And the last four out of those, Rafael Dos Anjos, former champ, Kevin Lee, Anthony Pettis, former champ, Donald Cerrone, a guy who's been at the top of the heap for the longest time. Tony Ferguson is one of those guys. We make the jokes about snap jitsu, and you talk about a strike, and you talk about a submission game, but this is the ultimate Swiss Army knife of a fighter, and he just does not go away.
Exactly, and I do think that's a great point to bring up. Tony Ferguson doesn't quit. It doesn't matter who you are, he's not going to give up. That man took untold amounts of damage against Justin Gaethje and just kept on marching forward, kept on marching forward. Charles Oliveira, Meryl Streep has a famous quote, where it is, the mixed martial arts are not the arts. She never saw Charles Oliveira fight. It might be one of the most beautiful things you can watch inside of sports. The way that he's able to use his jiu-jitsu is really unlike anyone else in the sport. He floats on top of people. He doesn't really ever get into set positions. It's just constantly floating, constantly attacking in different ways. And I think it's safe to say this might be the first fight where Tony Ferguson isn't the best grappler in it. And that's a really compelling thing to bring up, because Charles Oliveira, we knew him for the jiu-jitsu. We knew him for all the submissions. The boy's got hands all of a sudden, and he's got great Muay Thai. I think what he did against Kevin Lee, I get it, he won by submission. His striking looked phenomenal in that fight. And I do think we're getting a Charles Oliveira who at this point in his career is a lot more comfortable at 155. Remember when he first moved up? He fought Will Brooks. Shout out to Will Brooks. He fought Will Brooks, he beat him by submission, and they were like, wow, you look amazing at lightweight. And the first thing he said was, I'd love to go back down to featherweight. It was an awful idea back then. I do think he's realized that now. 155 is Charles Oliveira's home, and I do think this is a great fight for both guys. Tony Ferguson, all of his fights are fight of the night. I don't think we're bringing anyone anything new by saying Tony Ferguson's going to be in the fight of the night, but they found him the perfect dance partner to have that perfect sort of co-main event on your last pay-per-view.
And I mean, Doe Bronx, again, on an absolute tear. And you talk about the striking paired with the fact that he's training out of Shoot the Box, Diego Lima, down in Brazil. It's a perfect spot, and we've seen a lot of fighters really improve upon their Muay Thai. I'm going to bring up a little bit of a poor example, but you did see it in the later half of his fight. John Allen that we had just last weekend against Roman Delige. You could see him really stringing together striking. And I mean, that's just one example of a recent fighter, but a gym really known for a lot of their strikers. Charles Oliveira, really, to use my OMC reference, making moves and starting grooves before they knew we were gone. The guy has really brought it together. For Tony Ferguson, a guy that's trained with Eddie Bravo, that's really training now at a Snap Down MMA, his own gym, really bringing a lot of different aspects. You see this guy going off of, I don't know, the half balls and doing his weird kind of movement drills. He is one of the true enigmas in mixed martial arts, and a guy that you never want to miss a Tony Ferguson fight. His fight at UFC 229 against Anthony Pettis is probably one of the most memorable fights in my mind. It just so happened that we were in Smashville watching that fight. But overall, a great fight, a fight of the night contender for sure, and we'll talk a lot more about this fight as we get into the full card predictions. So Matt, we're really looking forward to a great card coming up this weekend, and hey, I gotta say, it's all thanks to the fans out there, Matt, because listen, we had question mark kicks on the weekend, we had a few technical difficulties, we had to go out there and pick up a new microphone, and listen, we're able to do things like this because of the good people that are out there that tune in week after week. You guys are really helping support us. And as a little bit of a sneak peek and an inside baseball type of reference, we're relaunching This Week in MMA this week. And we have a special guest on that's going to predict some of these fights that maybe you don't know him, maybe you will know him, and you're going to think, well, what? He's on an MMA show? He's not an MMA guy. He's not even a sports guy. But we've got a really good interview locked in. He's going to talk more about this card that's coming up. Matt, I was really excited to have him on.
How could you not be?
I know we're just kind of teasing it a little bit more, but we're able to do things like this again because of everybody out there. We're almost at 18,000 subscribers, which we started the year at barely even 1,000, and now we're up to this point. So it's been absolutely incredible and a crazy ride. Listen, we're looking to close out the picks really strong for the last few cards remaining this week. We also have Bellator this week, so if you're a Bellator fan, we're gonna have some Bellator content out there for you as well. But we're always looking to make moves, we're always looking to continue to gain on a strong year. So I just want to say that a special shout out to everybody out there. You made this an incredible year.
Yeah, 100%. We can't do this without you guys, and the support that this channel's got from the community is absolutely insane. You guys love the fights just as much as we do, and that's what makes it so much fun to talk about them with you. So, again, can't thank the fans enough.
All right, Matt. Well, you got a great card coming up, UFC 256. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. And as we always say, let's get into it. Matt, I will be 100% upfront and honest. I like some weird music. I mean, I like country music. I like the,
Polish dance music?
Yeah, I like Polish dance music, the type of music that you could go drinking on a tailgate on a Saturday night outside of a football game, but also some of the weirdest stuff you've ever heard. One song that I really like is You Make Me Feel Like I'm Living a Teenage Dream by Katy Perry. It's a classic. It's a good song. I'm not afraid to admit it. Chase Hooper's nickname is The Dream. And Matt, in this fight, Chase Hooper taking on Slippery Pete Barrett. And it's a weird fight. It's a crossroads fight. It's a prospect against an old vet. And when we talk about old vets, I mean, Peter Barrett only has one UFC fight to his name. It's a loss. It was his last fight against Yusuf Zalal. Zalal coming in on short notice in that one. Peter Barrett didn't manage all that well. He had moments, but it was mostly Barrett chasing Yusuf Zalal. And Yusuf Zalal working in his wrestling, It was a real short notice type of fight for Zalal, and it ended up costing him in his next short notice fight against Ilya Topuria, but that's another fight for another day. For Peter Barrett, though, it's just the overall body of work that he has. He's got an 11-4 record, but you look at some of the competition that he's faced, and it's a lot of guys from the regional scene. We always talk about this guy, and I've had the pleasure, I guess, of seeing him fight not once, but twice, Jay Ellis. Peter Barrett has a win over Jay Ellis, one of the most eclectic records you're ever going to find out there. You look at Jay Ellis in one hand, you look at Travis Fulton in the other, and they're like ships passing in the night. They never would have fought because one's a heavyweight, one's a lightweight, but it is what it is. So Jay Ellis, Peter Barrett, there's a connection there. But for Chase Hooper, it's a guy that you got to focus on because he just picked up his first career loss in his last fight. He's 9-1-1. In the fight against Alex Caceres, we talk about, you know, just an absolute drubbing. That fight was an absolute drubbing. Now, I know Alex Caceres didn't have this, you know, crazy work rate, and the judges might not have scored it in a weird way. I mean, it was 30-27 scores. Alex Caceres won that fight big time.
It could have been 30-26. It really could have been. And it's nothing against Chase Hooper. It's very weird that I'm breaking down a fight of a guy who's younger than I am, though. That's very odd to me, because I couldn't imagine having 11 professional fights at this point. When I think of Chase Hooper and his career moving forward, I don't ever think of him as a featherweight. I'll be honest. I do think of him more as a lightweight. And I do mean that as to Chase Hooper's not a finished product in the least bit. He's like Jell-O that you just put the powder in, you just put in the fridge. It needs a little bit of time to solidify. And for Chase Hooper, his skill set's a little green. He's phenomenal at jiu-jitsu. We all know how good he is on the ground. But that Alex Caceres fight, and it was weird because Hooper was the favorite going into that, even though he was so young. Caceres has been in UFC main events before. He's fought Sergio Pettis, Uriah Faber, like Alex
Max
Caceres,
Holloway.
Max Holloway, or Jair Rodriguez. He's a guy who's been around and done that, and he's been in the UFC for a very long time. And like you said, he beat the brakes off poor Chase Hooper. I kind of like it, though. And I know that's weird to say. He did take a lot of damage in that fight. But we were talking about this earlier with, and I'm going to mention this in another show, Roosevelt Roberts, when he fought Jim Miller, it was a lose-lose situation. Because if you beat a guy like Jim Miller, you're just fighting killers from that point on. And if you lose to a guy like Jim Miller, not really the worst thing in the world, you lost to a guy who's more established than you in the division. I see this fight being very similar for Chase Hooper. Yes, you lost to Alex Caceres, but when a guy is so young and he does have such a developing skill set, I do tend to think that we see the biggest sort of steps forward in progression after those after those really bad losses. And I think Chase Hooper's a guy, too, and I'm sure you're going to mention it, changed camp, has some great, really high-level sparring partners that he has to his benefit now. And Peter Barrett, it's a weird case, because I don't think Chase Hooper's going to come out here striking like Alex Pereira with one new camp. I do think that's going to take some time to kind of, I guess, round out his striking game. Peter Barrett's 100% going to have the striking advantage in this fight. It's just when you look at Barrett's weaknesses, they do play right into the strengths of Chase Hooper.
That's the thing. Peter Barrett's had long layoffs in his career. He's 13 years older than Chase Hooper. And Matt, you know, kind of looking at it, the fact that Peter Barrett splits time between Sityatong, Boston, to work his striking, trains at a Lozon's MMA as far as his groundwork. And I mean, there's so many good fighters that train out of there. You have the man himself, Joe Lozon, but you also have guys like Rob Font. You have the Devin Powells of the world that are really going to give you different looks. And I think a guy like Devin Powell would be the perfect example, actually, for Chase Hooper. Now, Powell didn't work out all that well in the UFC, owns his own gym in Summerhill, New Hampshire, guy out of Maine. And listen, I mean, I know a lot about Devin Powell because I see him a lot on the regional scene here. I say here, we're from the Maritimes, but in New England, I travel a lot to go cover the fights in New England. But the point being that a guy like that, just recently retired as well, would be perfect to try and emulate a guy like Chase Hooper because he's really long in his striking, he throws a lot of kicks, but he closes distance in a lot of the similar ways that Chase Hooper does. And this is a little bit of a, you know, maybe a bit of a discreditation to a guy like Devin Powell, but Powell, when he was in his 30s, fought a lot like Chase Hooper does early on in his early 20s. The striking, somewhat green, maybe not the best part of their game. But again, you want to see a Devin Powell fight, the fight against Marcus Cerin really showed how good his jiu-jitsu could be. But for Chase Hooper trying to round out his game, he went to 50-50 MMA, which is a gym owned by Ryan Hall. Right now there, you have Jordan Rinaldi that was in the UFC, submission specialist, submission artist. You have Ryan Hall again. But another guy that's been there, Corey Sandhagen. So those three guys, you're going to work your jiu-jitsu for sure, But very unorthodox strikers, those three as well.
And I do think that's a good point to bring up when you're talking about a guy who, it's not like Chase Hooper is set in a certain striking system, if you will, and he has to relearn something completely new. It's a very green skill set, and it's very base level, if you will. So it's not like he has to tear down what he already has and then build up something new and add those unorthodox strikes. I do think the fact that he is kind of early on in his MMA career, and really just in his striking career, if you will, I think that's a great benefit for him, because you're going to be able to add some of those techniques onto what... Again, it's not like Chase Hooper's going out there boxing your ears in. Like, he has good hands, he'll throw a little bit of kicks, but he's just so susceptible on the defensive end, and that's really what concerns him more than anything moving forward. Chase Hooper, if you want to fight like Mickey Gall or Damian Maia, go right ahead. There's nothing wrong with that. You can do the, I'm just going to shoot for takedowns, I'll really implement my ground and pound, my submission game. But again, the striking defense, if a guy like Alex Caceres is able to really tee off on you, it does concern me whether or not you beat Peter Barrett. It just does concern me moving forward with his UFC career.
The thing, too, is as far as the striking defense is concerned, even in the fight against Daniel Taymor, he was getting hit, he got rocked, he went back, hit Daniel Taymor with everything that he had, ended up picking the win up by ground and pound. He got on top of him and just started kind of, he looked like Alexander Semin playing for the Capitals, just wailing away in his Under Armour compression gear. Now, for Chase Hooper, 7 of his 9 overall wins are by finish. He's got 3 by TKO, 4 of them by submission. If you look at Peter Barrett, again, 9 of his 11 wins are by finish, 7 by knockout, 2 of them by submission. It's tough. I mean, it you is. Look at the fight that he had over on Contender Series against Sang Hoon Yoo. He got beat in the first round pretty bad, and then he rallied back in the second and third round. So he has that to himself. Again, in the fight against Yusuf Lal, he was really chasing a lot in that one. This one, kind of a tough one to try and predict, and I don't really love the odds because Chase Hooper opened up a minus 313. He's now a minus 406 average on best fight odds. For Peter Barrett, opened up a plus 246. He's now at a plus 308. If we have a look at the total Tapology votes, 545 total votes, 82% going Hooper, 67% of voters having to win by submission. Yikes.
I love how confident everyone else is in Chase Hooper. Again, I'll say it right now. Is Chase Hooper going to win? Probably, because this does feel like one of those matchups where it's, okay, we're going to give this young prospect who we see a future in, a guy who stylistically does match up with himself quite well. But Peter Barrett is one of those sort of upset-minded guys. And here's the problem with Chase Hooper. If the striking is still a really big problem, and if he goes out there striking like he did against Alex Caceres, I don't care who you are, you're probably going to be able to beat him, especially if you're at the UFC level. Because the fact that he was just able to get hit clean so many times going in, his hands dropped as he fatigued too. And that's something you hate to see in MMA fighters, but something you do see. Round one, their hands are like this. Round two, they're like this. And by round three, their hands are just kind of at their waist and they're throwing punches. Something to look out for with Chase Hooper moving forward. I think he'll get the win, but A, those odds are ridiculous. And B, I wish I had as much confidence as the Tapology voters do.
I mean, Matt, this is a really tough one because you got a young guy at 21 years old whose body hasn't fully matured whatsoever, and he hasn't grown into his frame, and that's going to be an issue, especially at 145 pounds. You look at Peter Barrett, he's not 40, but he's a man. He's a man. So you got a young guy taking on a fully developed man. And listen, Chase Hooper's been fighting men so far. He's got 11 pro fights, but Peter Barrett, as salty as his record is and as tricky as his last fight was, he is game and he's gonna last. And that's one of those things that I worry about in a fight for Chase Hooper. So he has made those camp changes. He can get the submissions. And ultimately, I will slightly side with Chase Hooper. If I was A, able to not make a pick, I wouldn't on this one. And B, this is as big of a pass as I have on this card. So Matt, we're both going to go with Chase Hooper very reluctantly. I'm looking forward to this fight. It is a weird one. It's on some sites and it's not on some sites too. So it's not on the UFC stats website. It is on the UFC's website. It is on Tapology and it is on Best Fight Odds. So we'll see if the fight actually materializes. Chase Hooper's kind of posted some stuff on Instagram. The fact that he's done some promo for UFC 256. Peter Barrett looks like he's actively training for a fight coming up very shortly on his Instagram. So we'll see if the fight even happens, but hopefully. I do have to throw that out there as a disclaimer. Again, already tonight as we speak, as we begin to get ready, Angela Hill's out of her fight with Tisha Torres. So we'll see what happens. But again, both of us going with Chase Hooper. Again, I would not throw this in as a parlay piece. We'll see what happens. It is a great card. Figueiredo taking on Moreno in the main event. So Matt, keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Matt, really looking forward to our next fight coming up on UFC 256 at heavyweight. And hey, we have a UFC debut from The Mountain, and I'm not talking about the guy from Game of Thrones. But I am talking about a heavyweight in Jared Vandera making his UFC debut representing Team Quest from the Pacific Northwest. And Matt, this is a guy that can get it done in a lot of different ways. He just earned his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He has a background in wrestling. We've seen his striking in his MMA career so far. And if you look at his total body of work, 11-4, 10 of those 11 wins by finish, three submissions, 7 wins by knockout. You saw his big win against Harry Hunsucker, one of the weirdest names in all of sports, over on Dana White's Contender Series just over a month ago, and it was one of those knock-him-out, grind-him-out type of fights where Hunsucker really brought it at him at the start, eventually kind of sort of tired out a little bit, and Vandera able to take over. And I mean, you look at his overall body of work, and Matt, both of these guys have taken on the one and only Tony Lopez. And Matt, for a guy that has, or at the time, had 95 professional fights, 95 have entered the cage, only 31 at the time have picked up wins. Jared Vandera, one of those guys. Sergey Spivak, also one of those guys. So both these guys, again, share that win in common. And on the left side of our screen, Sergey Spivak, the polar bear. So far in the UFC, it's been slightly mixed bags, and they both enter off a win over Tony Lopez. For Spivak, he ends up drawing Walt Harris, gets finished in that fight incredibly quickly. It was in the first minute of the first round. Then he beats Tai Tuivasa, then he loses to Marcin Tybura, and he beats Carlos Felipe in his last time out. A lot of people were surprised about the Felipe win. I know Felipe was coming off of about a 2 years USADA suspension, or there were some USADA issues in there. And Felipe, for what it's worth, looked pretty good against Jorgen De Castro in his last time out. So for Sergey Spivak, to me, the Tuivasa win just continues to look better and better because he really dominated on the ground. And say what you will about Tai Tuivasa, but again, in his last fight against the skyscraper, Stefan Struve, he looked pretty good. So knocked him out twice, too. I mean, just hopping up on the cage. Sometimes you land a heel on a guy's head once he's already been knocked out, and boom goes the dynamite. So again, for Sergey Spivak, his base, he definitely has a good, sambo background to his credit. We see that really implemented into his game. You hear about a lot of fighters with sambo backgrounds. I know Rafael Fiziev, that's going to be fighting later on in the card against Sonato Moicano. He has one, but primarily a Muay Thai kickboxer type of fighter representing Tiger Muay Thai. But for Sergey Spivak, he can really bring it in a lot of different ways. One thing that he does that I don't know if a lot of people really focus in on, he throws a lot of wild shots, and he'll throw spinning stuff that doesn't normally land. So you get Spivak, a lighter heavyweight, if you will, weighed in at 240 his last fight. For Jared Vandera, weighed in at 263, a lot bigger guy in Vandera, a lot smaller of a guy in Spivak. And to me, I look at this fight as old guard, new guard.
I see it a little bit differently, I have to be honest. Jared Vandera in that Hunsucker fight, it wasn't always great, the fact that he was so much bigger. He did have really good positions in that fight, but the start of that fight, he was at a big speed disadvantage. And not to say Sergey Spivak's going to be the guy to go out there and really outstrike Vandera and expose him on the feet. Just something to kind of look forward to moving forward. The smaller guys and that speed did really give Vandera issues. Now, of course, it's really easy to say he came back and he won that fight by first round TKO due to ground and pound. So it's not like it was that bad of a performance from Vandera. It will be interesting, though, because Sergey Spivak, we've seen him dominate in the grappling, but we've also kind of seen him dominated at other points. The Marcin Tybura fight, and I know Tybura is kind of weird because in some performances he looks really good, like in the Spivak one, and then in other performances he just looks tired and doesn't really do an awful lot. So it does really vary case by case, especially with Spivak, but I do like a lot of the positives that we have seen. I do think the Tai Tuivasa fight was a really good one, and it did show that I was worried in that fight because Walt Harris, phenomenal striker, really explosive guy, and he was able to get to Spivak very fast, and the first shot he landed pretty much put him down. Tai Tuivasa, although I wouldn't say he throws with the same power that a Walt Harris does, he does have phenomenal striking in his own right, and the fact that Spivak was able to kind of stand with him for a little bit, figure out what his game was, and the second that fight went to the ground, it wasn't even close. So this fight really does come down to who can get that top position. If Sergey Spivak's on top of Jared Vandera, he's going to beat the absolute brakes off him. He's going to land really good ground and pound. He'll probably set up. He's got a really nice head and arm choke. He likes going for that instead of passing all the way to mount. If he's in side control, he'll kind of set that up. It's a really nice position for him. But if Vandera's on top of Spivak, it's going to be the exact same problem. I really doubt Vandera will fish for the submission as much as Spivak would, but his ground and pound is definitely violent on top.
That's the thing. I mean, Jared Vandera, with the background in wrestling, comes in having just earned his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. So I have to give credit where credit's due, Matt. I've got the paper notes this week, and I read an article on Medium. And listen, you don't trust everything you read on Medium, but there was a Q&A there with Justin Santinetti. And this one's from July, before the fight that Vandera had on Contender Series. And there were a lot of really interesting points that were made, but the fact that he talked about really wanting to beat Justin Gaethje's leg kick ratio in the UFC, I thought was absolutely insane. Also learned from some of the interviews and especially that Q&A as well, the fact that he had recently earned his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. Definitely something neat. I know if you look at it over on his Tapology page, the fact that he represents, again, Dan Henderson's Athletic Fitness Center, Team Quest, one and the same. Exactly. But he's been training in California for this one out of an affiliate Team Quest location. So I don't know what it's going to be like as far as the level of training partners that we're going to see. From Sergey Spivak, we actually do know he trains with some really, really high-level guys. You can see that up there on screen. But, I mean, for Jared Vandera, again, this to me is one of those fights where you get a guy that's 6'4", so he has a height advantage ever so slightly, has a reach advantage, and he's one of those classic heavyweights. One of those guys that we saw 10 to 12 years ago where I'm a huge fucking heavyweight. I can wrestle, and I can strike, and I can eat a shot, so I'm probably going to go far. You know who Jared Vandera reminds me of? I'm talking about the fluffer for Brock Lesnar, Chris Tuchscher, a guy that really made it far on all of those attributes, and then he got close to the top, and that was as far as he was going to go, because he wasn't really good at grappling. He was a good wrestler. His striking was pretty good. Then his chin started to kind of fall apart, and the wheels just fell off. But Chris Tuchscher, you want to go find a guy with traps? Go find Chris Tuchscher. You don't hear much about him anymore. So for Jared Vandera, he's one of those guys that can really withstand a lot of punishment. I look at Jared Vandera and I place him in the same class, and maybe this is a little unfair on my part, as a guy like Josh Parisian that we saw come in just a couple of weeks ago against Parker Porter. Parker Porter also in that category too. Like, they're these great big guys at heavyweight that kind of do everything well. They can strike. Again, with Parker Porter, he'll throw some low kicks. Jared Vandera does actually throw a lot of them. You could see that in the fight against Harry Hunsucker early. You saw Vandera start to chop, but what Hunsucker would do is he'd run in with his right hand and just start smashing. And that guy, the speed on him was insane. Like, you rarely see heavyweights throw like that. For Sergey Spivak, again, throws a lot of those spinning shots that don't always land. He kind of gauges distance in a weird way. And if all else fails, then he just goes in for the takedown. It's worked a lot. And hey, credit where credit's due. It's worked against a lot of really big heavyweights too. Because for Tui Vasa, for Carlos Felipe, for Tony Lopez. I mean, again, the man's been in there over 90 times as a pro fighter. And for Spivak to get a win over him 2 years ago with WWFC, that's a good win. It is a quality win.
It is. And I got to be honest, I think the size of Jared Vandera is actually going to be a big detriment in this fight. Sergey Spivak does one thing that really takes advantage of his opponent's immense size, if you will. That's single leg takedowns. And there's a reason that Daniel Cormier really only uses single legs, especially at heavyweight and light heavyweight. The bigger you are, the harder it is to balance on that one leg. Now, if you are dealing with like a Marcin Tybura type, size-wise and the physicality, he'll be able to sort of bear on you and get the leg free. But with a guy like Jared Vandera, I do see Sergey Spivak fishing for that single leg, really making him tired. And as the fight progresses, Spivak is one of the few guys at heavyweight who is fresh for three rounds. He does have a pretty good output. And in the Carlos Felipe fight, he rallied in that fight. It was very close for the first two rounds. And the third round, it wasn't even close. And he completely dominated a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt on the mat. And to me, that was a very impressive performance by Spivak. Maybe not against the most impressive opponent, but I did really like his performance in that one. So may have given away who my pick is a little early, but that's definitely where I'm leaning.
If we look at the odds, Matt, I actually think that they're insane. I think the opening odds made a lot more sense. But right now, Sergey Spivak, a -228 favorite, open at a -145. If you look at Jared Vandera, he's right now a +184, opened up at a +125. Over on Tapology, out of 535 total votes, 84% going Spivak, 51% going submission. I would not feel all that confident in that pick. I mean, I will agree. I'm going with Sergey Spivak. You just have to make a case for both guys. Because, again, with Jared Vandera, he's got a wrestling base. He's got a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He's coming out of a camp and a pedigree that's bred a lot of really good wrestlers and a lot of guys with staying power. I do worry about the amount of punishment that he takes on the feet, though. And if you look at Jared Vandera's overall record and the guys that he's fought, it's pretty weak. I mean, you look at the Tony Lopez win. That is good. We talked about it. Spivak finished him. Vandera beat him by decision. Harry Hunsucker, though, was a layup of an opponent if I've ever seen one, and he really brought the fight to him. And if you look at his record, going into that one, Hunsucker beating guys 9-14, 15-7, 1-0, 2-5, pro debut. Like, he hadn't faced the best level of competition. You look at Vandera's losses just a year ago, Henan Fahea. I went and watched a bunch of Henan Fahea fights, got really excited about him. So maybe we end up seeing him in the UFC at some point. But the guys that he beat in EFC when he was a champ, I mean, Ricky Meschulis at 7-7, Ruan Potts, a UFC legend. He beat him at the time when he was kind of over the hill. And Elvis Moyo, who's 8-5. So again, that level of competition really hasn't been there. I do like the guys that Sergey Spivak has faced. I like the Sambo background. I like the fact that if this fight gets into a clinch, I have a lot more confidence in a guy like Sergey Spivak with the upper body throws that he's going to be able to have. And you talked about it. He has a great single leg. Bringing all of those things together into an MMA fight, I really do favor the younger fighter in this one. So I will side ever so slightly with Sergey Spivak. But to me, this is a push or a pass on my card, if anything.
So I do agree with you. I like the odds a lot more when they open. Although I am picking Spivak, the fact that he's minus 230 doesn't make any sense, really. It will be an interesting fight because, again, Vandera does have the wrestling, and we could see him try to take down Spivak, but I do see it once the fight hits the mat, when it comes to the overall grappling of both guys, I just trust Spivak a lot more. I know that if he is going to go for the ground and pound, it might open up submissions, whereas for Vandera, he might just keep on pounding away, and it could even be a detriment, and he could gas himself out. And against one of the more, it's hard to say athletic, but I would say one of the more active, if you will, heavyweights, who he does have a good output, he does have good footwork. You know Spivak's going to have that staying power through 15, and I like Spivak in this one.
Matt, both going with the Moldovan to get the win. You don't hear that very often. I'm really looking forward to this card. I know we've had quite a few fights drop out. And hey, a little bit of tidbit. I mean, since yesterday, I've shaved because this is a whole new day. We're in the same clothes for continuity, but we've had multiple fights fall out. So that being said, you want to keep locked in with Fight Night Picks because as this event changes, we'll be bringing you more and more coverage. So as we always say, Matt, with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Really looking forward to this fight at featherweight. We have the Maritimes' own Gavin Governor Tucker taking on Billy Quarantillo coming out of Tampa Bay. And Matt, for Tampa's own, happy birthday, Billy Quarantillo. Turns 32 this week on December the 8th. And Matt, this is a fight where you kind of look at both these guys as possibly prospects. I know Billy Quarantillo had a shot on The Ultimate Fighter season 22. The season where Artem Lobov was a creeper on the pool. And for Gavin Tucker, this is a guy that came into the UFC with a lot of fanfare. He was Joe Rogan's guy for all of 20 seconds. And that came off his performance in his UFC debut. We happened to be there at the Metro Center in Halifax, Nova Scotia, way back in 2017. You had Travis Brown taking on Derek Lewis in the main event. Mario Yamasaki had other plans for poor Travis Brown in that one. But overall, Gavin Tucker won the night. I mean, this is a guy that a lot of people weren't familiar with. Overall, he was billed as being out of Newfoundland, representing Halifax with Titans MMA. There's always going to be a connection to TJ Grant there. Overall, in that performance, there was a little bit Fergie. There was a little bit Jesus. There was a little bit Dominic Cruz. There was a little bit Cody Garbrandt. And in his performance, Gavin Tucker looked absolutely amazing. He was stunting on Cecilia. He was pointing down to the floor. He was outboxing him. He looked amazing. And then in his next fight, Matt, what happened?
He got beat very badly by Rick Glenn. Now, if you're going to tell the full Gavin Tucker story, you do really have to dissect that performance against Sam Cecilia, because it is really hard to get Joe Rogan's recognition, and that it is worth a lot, especially in today's, you know, sports entertainment society. And Gavin Tucker put on an absolute show against Cecilia. Very Cody Garbrandt-esque. He was stunting on him, like you had said, pointing his finger down to the ground, trying to get him to brawl like Max Holloway. It was a really impressive performance, and it was one of the performances that almost transcended just the fight itself. It was something that people were talking about really weeks after the fight was over, and they thought Gavin Tucker was a real contender at 145. Now, of course, he went on to fight Rick Glenn at UFC 215, and things didn't really go his way. He did start out the fight looking really good. He has really good movement and whatnot. And then he got dropped bad. And it was just one thing after another. The snowball effect kind of went on from there. And it is interesting, too, because you look at the guys who Gavin Tucker has had trouble with. You know, the more power-oriented fighters. Billy Quarantillo, you look at him, he's not really a power puncher by any means, but he's a guy who can put together combinations and hurt you with single shots. And that's something Gavin Tucker really has to worry about in this fight.
And I mean, with Gavin Tucker, so he loses that Rick Glenn fight, and then he's out for an extended period of time. This is a guy coming into the UFC, already into his 30s. He's now 34. So is he still a prospect? You always have to ask that question. I mean, he's got 13 pro fights. But to this point, so far in the UFC, only four of them, and he's 3-1 so far. The comeback win over Sung Woo Choi was a big one. That one also in Canada about a year and a half ago, a year and 4 months ago. Picks up the third round win there. His output from the second or from the first to the second round went up, and then in the third round he gets a finish. And then in his last fight against Justin James, he had two very similar styles where we've seen out of Gavin Tucker that his wrestling's quite good. He definitely has good submission skills. And on the feet, he just throws one added X factor compared to Justin James, where I'm not so much a wrestle boxer. I'll open up that southpaw stance so I can accentuate that kick coming from the back. And he does have a really nice kick, and he can throw it at different ranges between his opponents, but he can throw it at different levels as well, which maybe you don't often see. You see the commentary always talking week in, week out. Boys, this guy or gal has a great calf kick. That's so good. But you don't hear them talking about the kick to the thigh, the kick to the knee, maybe one that's going up high. And we did see that a little bit in last weekend's main event with Jack Hermanson, where he was finding success with his kicks until, well, he broke his foot and then he couldn't throw them anymore. But for Gavin Tucker, it's essential that if he's probably going to get a win, he definitely needs to start building up those kicks early.
Oh, without a doubt. I do think that is the key, especially when you look at Billy Quarantillo. He's a really high stance fighter. He will sort of have his chin up in the air. And if Gavin Tucker can, he does duck and throw looping shots. Now, he will throw really good combinations as well. You rarely will see just sort of that one fire. He'll kind of pitter-patter with two shots and then throw a really hard either hook or kick or whatever. And then that's the shot that he's looking to damage you with. I like the wrestling from Gavin Tucker too. He uses his own footwork quite well. And it's more, it is an offensive and a defensive tool. He can use it to sneak into range to then grab a quick or double leg. He can use it to evade his opponent. It's something you do have to worry about because he will overuse his movement sometimes to the point where he's just doing a lot extra that he doesn't really have to. It's a lot of wasted energy that he doesn't really have to put out, but it's something that does apply to his style. Billy Quarantillo, he's had a really weird UFC run because his biggest win is, of course, over Spike Carlisle. But Spike Carlisle, it's really weird to place him in the division. Is he, you know, a future contender? Is he just an exciting fighter? We really don't know, but it was a nice performance from Quarantillo. He started off pretty weak in that fight. Spike Carlisle was landing big shots. He took him down multiple times, but Quarantillo, just as the fight progressed, you could tell, it was just sort of that slow erosion away at Spike. He was able to really take advantage of his phenomenal cardio and just sort of put it on Carlisle down the stretch. And I thought that was a really important performance. The Kyle Nelson fight afterwards, I don't really think you can take much from that because it was a fairly one-sided fight from Quarantillo. You like the confidence that you see in that third round before the knockout, though, because he basically just walked across the cage with his hands down, threw one punch and knocked out Kyle Nelson. It was a very impressive performance.
Kyle Nelson kind of fights like Kimo Leopoldo when he walked to the cage. He almost walks like he doesn't necessarily have a cross on his back, but maybe just a sheet of plywood because he stands a damn square with his hands relatively low. I mean, if he does block, he does the Justin Gaethje, but he doesn't do it all that well. So Matt, now I have to bring in the prop. We get the Carlos Newton signed Canadian flag. And of course, we have Gavin Tucker in this fight representing our region, really. I mean, we're out of New Brunswick. He's out of Nova Scotia by way of Newfoundland. Billy Quarantillo, though, and the reason why I bring that flag out, this is an interesting stat about him. He's 3-0 against Canadians. And if you look at his overall body of work, he's faced some decent Canadians so far. So you talk about his last win, it's over Kyle Nelson. We look at his UFC body work. Are there any other Canadians there? No, not necessarily. He does have a win over Adrian Veleka, who it just so happened that we interviewed him on this channel before that fight. We interviewed Veleka, didn't quite work out for him. And he also has a win over Matthew DiMarcantonio that we happen to cover one of his weirder fights in a main event for Fighting Alliance 7 Legends in St. John, New Brunswick, Canada at the old LBR. So shouts to all you Maritimers that know what I'm talking about. But either way, in this fight, Billy Quarantillo beats Canadians. He has good wrestling. He throws good combinations together. And I think he has a really underrated ground game. And maybe not so much because you got to see it in that Spike Carlisle fight. Because as that fight went on, the tide really started to go out for Carlisle after he really just put all of his energy into the end of the first round. And then after that, it was pretty well all Quarantillo for the rest of that fight. And in his UFC tenure, he gets that win over Camilla Kirk in his Dana White Contender Series bout a little over a year ago, almost a year and a half ago. In that fight, rallied, got a big finish in that one late. He beats Jacob Kilburn in their UFC debuts. Jacob Kilburn is not UFC level. Carlisle and then Kyle Nelson. So for Billy Quarantillo, if we have a look at the odds, he opened up as a favorite at about a minus 140. Then the money came in on Tucker. Now it's just slightly in for Quarantillo. So it's going all over the place. For Gavin Tucker, open a plus 120. Then it was Pick'em. Now he's a slight underdog. The Tapology votes paint a totally different picture, Matt, because out of 794 total votes, 80% Quarantillo, and out of that 80%, 74% happened by decision. How do you see this one here?
So I don't see a finish for either guy. I think both guys have proven that they're more than durable throughout their UFC careers. I am siding with Billy Quarantillo, though. I like his cardio. I like his output a lot. I do worry a little bit about that extra movement of Gavin Tucker. If for Gavin Tucker to win this fight, though, he has to mix in his takedowns with his striking. He's a little Frankie Edgar-ish in that respect, where to really open up the full capacity of his striking game, he is going to have to rely a little bit on the feints, or at least the threat of the takedown. But I like Billy Quarantillo. I like a submission defense. I like a submission offense. I like the fact that he will damage his opponent even from his back. He's kind of Tony Ferguson-esque in that respect, where he's going to throw those elbows like Michael Bisping against GSP. I just like Quarantillo in this one.
And I mean, hey, will he continue on that Canadian streak and go 4-0 here? I don't know. But I look at Gavin Tucker and I look at the two losses, and I mean, en français, ça vaut la peine, because Billy Quarantillo looks a lot like Rick Glenn. He's got the goatee at most points. He's tall. He's lanky. And I mean, not that they fight incredibly similarly, but I'd like to see Billy Q in the PFL. We'd see what happens. Yeah. Who knows? Just like Rick Glenn, World Series champ. But in the fight that Glenn had against Gavin Tucker, it was an uppercut straight up the middle that dropped Tucker and really set off his problems. And you want to talk about that Rick Glenn fight. One of the judges scored at 30-24. I was surprised more of the judges didn't score it along those lines, because that was an absolute beatdown by Rick Glenn. It's a shame that we didn't get to see more of Rick Glenn, or we haven't seen more.
Yeah, it is, but again, Gavin Tucker, I think that fight showed that there's some susceptibilities, if you will, to his style, and I think Quarantillo could take advantage.
Same thing in the Justin James fight. That's the other thing that I wanted to say, because James dropped Tucker in the first round of their fight, similar shot up the middle. Justin James not really known for shots up the middle. He's the looping shots, crashing forward. Now, he did crash into it, but it was up the middle. So for Billy Quarantillo, there's a lot of paths to victory. For Gavin Tucker, there certainly is as well. Again, southpaw starts throwing those kicks early, mixing in the wrestling, trying to tire down Billy Quarantillo. Not necessarily worried about the gas tank, really, either guy. So it should be a very entertaining fight. And Matt, if we didn't have Ferguson Oliveira up near the top, this would definitely be a contender for fight of the night.
Without
it. I'm really looking forward to it. So again, the final pick here.
Oh, Billy Quarantillo. I think this is going to be a phenomenal fight. I think it's going to go all three rounds. It's going to be really back and forth, but I'm sticking with Billy Q.
Matt, I'm also going with Billy Quarantillo. Really looking forward to this card. We have a lot of great fights. I just mentioned Tony Ferguson taking on Charles Oliveira in the co-main event. And in the main event, it is for flyweight gold. Deiveson Figueiredo taking on the assassin, baby, Brandon Reno. You're not going to want to miss that. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. Normally with Fight Night Picks, we talk about a lot of these fights, and if we get lucky, we say, hey, this one is a true striker's paradise. Matt, this fight is definitely not a striker's paradise, it's a grappler's paradise, and I'm really looking forward to it. We have Mackenzie Dern taking on Verna Jandihoba, and Matt, for Miss Carcara, she's coming in here with a full head of steam. The one loss was on a short notice bout against Carla Sparza. Wasn't able to pick up the win there. But overall, out of the body of work from both of these two fighters, 19 of 25 total wins are by submission. That's absolutely insane. It's going to be hard for you to find a better grappler in mixed martial artists than Mackenzie Dern. She is as pure of a grappler as they come. But her striking's starting to come together, and she's still very young in her career here at 9-1. Again, that one loss to Amanda Ribas, and whether it's at 125 pounds or 115 pounds, Amanda Ribas, she is on her way to the top. So for Verna Jandihoba, coming in here, former Invicta strawweight champion, she looked great in her last two fights. The Mallory Martin one was really quick, and it was done with. And in her last one, she looked amazing as well against good competition. It was a big name, I guess, in Felice Herrig. She finished her in the first round. Mallory Martin was in the second round, rear naked choke win. So for Verna Jandihoba, continues to gain and really make moves in this division. For Mackenzie Dern, we talk about her last two wins. Hannah Cypher and Miranda Marcos, a tale of two totally different fighters. What did you make out of those two wins?
Okay, you can't take a lot from those wins, but I do think you can take a lot from at least the performance that Mackenzie Dern put on, and I do think that this ties in perfectly to what Verna Jandihoba does. Mackenzie Dern is basically the female's MMA's Damian Maia. Now, she is training her striking with Jason Perillo. He's posted a lot of videos of her in the gym, and her striking does look like it is making progress. Now, of course, they're going to put out good footage. They're not going to show her like CM Punk at Rufus Sport, but she has been putting in the time, and she at least has been going to Ruka for a while. So you are going to make the improvements if you spend the time there. And with Jason Perillo, you know what kind of a striking coach he is. And if Mackenzie Dern really can just fix the striking aspect of her game, she can be a real problem for a long time to come. Her grappling is otherworldly compared to everyone else in this division. You never see knee bars. She got one off of her back. You very rarely see Reyna Marcos have trouble with the grappling. Again, the strikers give her all types of problems. But just the fact that Mackenzie Dern was able to go out there and submit her so fast, I think just kind of proves or hammers home the point that we all knew. Mackenzie Dern on the mat is a monster. Now, Verna Jandihoba, I can be honest. Is she the better striker between these two? I would say by quite a bit. Is she the better wrestler? Yes, she is. Is her submission game very, very good? Of course it is. And she is going to be able to implement that against 99% of the women that she's ever going to fight. This is the one matchup that she will not have the grappling advantage in. And that really worries me because Mackenzie Dern has grappled Gabby Garcia and beat her in straight jiu-jitsu. And I really doubt Verna's going to come out here and put on a striking clinic. Like I said, she's definitely the better striker out of these two. But for her to really win this game, she's going to have to go for the takedown at some point. It's been the story of her career for the majority of it. She's going to want to get the fight to the mat and use her submission game. Now, for Verna Jandihoba, I do think from the top position, she'll be able to get away some good ground and pound. She is a good enough grappler in her own right that I doubt she's going to get caught early on by something that Mackenzie Dern does, like a Reyna Marcos was able to, or like she was able to do with Hannah Cyphers. But again, stylistically, this is just a really hard fight for Jandihoba.
It's a hard fight for either fighter. It really is. I mean, for Mackenzie Dern, let's look at the wins. So, Reyna Marcos, who's a good wrestler, decent striker, but Reyna Marcos, I gotta talk about that a little bit, because that fight was back in, September. Reyna Marcos, the entirety of this year, maybe less the Brazil fight, because the big news was when her and John McDessie both came back from Brazil, they had to quarantine for 2 weeks, and everybody thought that was preposterous. Well, I hate to tell you, but that's commonplace up here in Canada.
Raptors are playing in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, that's how it works. So it is what it is, but I say that because Reyna Marcos is used to cross-training in the States, and I have to bring that up because her 2020 has not been good whatsoever, and I think she's really suffered from that, the fact that she hasn't been able to spend time in Windsor and in Detroit, and I think she spends a little bit of time in Ann Arbor, too. All that to say, I discount that win a little bit. The Hannah Cyphers win, too. The Hannah Cyphers was just, it was like any given Sunday. Well, let's just throw Hannah Cyphers out there and see what she can do. And again, her year didn't go all that well. Amanda Hibas, it's tough to beat Amanda Hibas.
Mackenzie Dern was coming off having a kid, and she took that fight way too early.
Yeah, so that is true. Amanda Bobby Cooper, negative record, no longer in the UFC. Ashley Yoder, now she is a tough out. And Mackenzie Dern won that fight by split decision. Understandably, I could see you make an argument for either fighter in that one. Ashley Yoder, Spider Monkey, sketchy, and hard to fight. And then the wins that she had on the regional scene, you can't really talk about them. I mean, good win over Montana De La Rosa, or it looks good now, I guess. But again, Mackenzie Dern's a way better grappler.
I don't think you can discredit all of her wins like that. I really don't. I think that's super unfair to Mackenzie Dern. She has never even had a competitive fight hit the ground. The second any of her opponents either take her down or she gets the takedown, she is immediately in top position. So I don't think that we can just look at every win she's ever had and put a caveat next to it.
She picks up really quick wins, and there's one thing, and again, I think hopefully you can probably already tell we're going to disagree here, but if we look at those last two wins, Hannah Cyphers, Reyna Marcos, 2 minutes and 37 or 36 seconds to win over Cyphers, 3 minutes and 44 seconds over Reyna Marcos. If Mackenzie Dern's going to get a win in this fight, and again, we can go through it. First round finish over Amanda Bobby Cooper. Third round finish over Kayleen Medeiros. First round over Polk. First round over De La Rosa. If Mackenzie Dern's going to get a win here, A, does it have to be by submission? Do you think she'd get a win by decision in this one? And B, does it have to be sooner than later in a fight like this?
I don't think it is, because this fight will take place at her pace. That is the one good news for Mackenzie Dern. Again, I don't think Mackenzie Dern's the better martial artist out of these two fighters. I just think that for Verna Jandihoba to win this fight, she has to go into Mackenzie Dern's specialty at some point. She will not be able to just stand on the outside and outstrike Mackenzie Dern. If she does, this can be one of the worst fights you've ever seen, because you don't really want to see a Verna Jandihoba Mackenzie Dern kickboxing fight.
Or do you?
You really don't. It's not going to become one of those like Colby Covington, Kamaru Usman fights where it actually turns out to be really entertaining. Both of these two are very green and they're striking. One of the few things that I do kind of like from Mackenzie Dern, she throws everything behind every shot. And if you don't have very good striking at and I'm not going to call this a lower level women's MMA fight, but Macy Barber kind of proved it. If you have big power, good aggression, and good takedown defense, you can beat pretty much anyone on your way up the rankings. Now, of course, eventually you will sort of reach a threshold where that doesn't work anymore. But for Mackenzie Dern, if you just have Brian Ortega jiu-jitsu and you're really aggressive with your punching, we can see what we want about Amanda Bobby Cooper and her UFC run. She lost to a lot of killers. And in the fight against Dern, Dern dropped her with a punch and then choked her out. It wasn't just like it's all been her jiu-jitsu the whole time. So I do think Dern has started to show progress, but again, she's fighting someone who's better than her at almost everything, so it is hard to pick Dern.
That's the weird thing. Both of these women have negative striking differentials, which is kind of crazy to think of. Mackenzie Dern's grappling line is absolutely insane. Her takedowns average per 15 minutes is 0.39. Verna Jandihoba, 4.57. Mackenzie Dern's takedown accuracy, 7%. Her takedown defense, 0%. You know why? She doesn't mind getting taken down. For Verna Jandihoba, 50% accuracy and 60% takedown defense. But she's attempting way more takedowns in a fight. She actually averages more submissions per 15 minutes as well, just slightly above. As far as the striking, Mackenzie Dern, the busier striker. Verna Jandihoba, a little bit more accurate. The defense, it's a bit of a wash. Both orthodox fighters. It's a close fight, but I like what you talked about. And friend of the show, Drake Riggs, actually had a really good interview and a piece out there about Verna Jandihoba. She's been one with nature. This has been one of her best training camps so far. So I urge you to check that out. I'll link it down below. Always got to help out friends of the show. But again, overall, you have one of the best female grapplers in the world in her prime against one of the better up-and-coming, maybe even slept-on fighters in this division, and Verna Jandihoba, who has so many wins by submission, former Invicta champ. I mean, she had a win over Mizuki Inoue over there by split decision. If we have a look at the odds, Matt, and I have the paper copy right here, Mackenzie Dern is a minus 181 favorite, up from a minus 156 open, average on best fight odds. For Verna Jandihoba, a plus 151 open, a plus 129. Out of the total votes on Tapology, 872, 76% have Mackenzie Dern, 69% have her to win by submission. Matt, what's the final pick here?
I am going to agree with the audience. I know this might not be a popular pick. You guys might just think that we're trying to, or I'm trying to appeal to the masses, but no. Mackenzie Dern versus Verna Jandihoba reminds me of one fight. Gunnar Nelson versus Damian Maia. And it really comes down to a basic concept. You might be good at jiu-jitsu, but Mackenzie Dern is great at it. And if you go back and watch that fight, I know Damian Maia is like god tier for jiu-jitsu, but still, he absolutely dominated Gunnar Nelson, who in his own right is a phenomenal grappler. So I do see Verna has to get the takedown at some point. And the second that she is able to get it, because of course, Mackenzie Dern doesn't even care about defending takedowns. She will not even put in the effort. The second you go for a takedown, she might as well pull guard, because that is really all she's doing. She just wants to get the fight to the mat however she can. And I think once the fight does hit there, she can be attacking with different submissions off her back. If she's able to get a sweep, I think the fight's going to be 100% in her favor. She's going to be the bigger of the two fighters. I really like Mackenzie Dern in this one.
Matt, I'm just really looking forward to this, because again, we opened the video by saying, oh, well, normally you're saying striker's paradise. This is the absolute opposite of that, unless, yeah, again, you end up with a Covington-Usman fight, hopefully, which I hope we don't in this one. But overall, I have to disagree. I'm going to go with Verna Jandihoba, because I do like her jiu-jitsu. I like her base. I like the fact that, again, if she has to work the takedown, is she going to be timid about it? We'll have to find out on Saturday night. But overall, I do like her complete MMA game. Again, you can talk about the striking stats, the fact that Dern lands more, but she gets hit more, and vice versa. But she's had some close fights. Again, that Ashley Yoder fight is a little bit tricky. Now, Yoder, she oddly has really good head and arm throws. She has a good clinch game as well. And when space is open, she can strike. So if Verna Jandihoba can really incorporate a lot of different things that we've seen thrown at Dern, there's a good possibility that Jandihoba gets the win. Would I say it's the most confident pick I have on the card? Definitely not, but I am really looking forward to this one. So I'm going with Verna Jandihoba. Matt, you're going with Mackenzie Dern. I'm really looking forward to this fight. We have a great card headlined by Deiveson Figueiredo taking on the assassin baby, Brandon Moreno. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. Matt, we got a couple old folks fighting at featherweight as Cub Swanson is taking on Daniel the Pit Pineda. Matt, I'm really excited about this fight because Daniel Pineda in his UFC debut put on an absolute masterclass. I mean, sometimes you go on YouTube, you're looking for stuff to do. They can teach you how to make videos. They can teach you how to cook. If you watch Daniel Pineda's fight against Herbert Burns, you're going to learn how to maul a man. And in that fight, he looked absolutely amazing. And Matt, with full transparency, we picked Burns to win that fight.
We did.
But throw that completely out. Don't watch that video. Forget about everything that we said in that one. Daniel Pineda is absolutely on one of the biggest heaters I've seen in a while, because since he left the UFC, his only two losses are in Bellator. He lost by finish due to a cut against Georgi Karhanian. Now, listen, if you watch the fight that Karhanian had against AJ McKee, it wasn't very good. But if you watch his overall body of work, like I have, because I'm a weird guy, Georgi Karhanian, low-key pretty good.
Monster.
The other loss that Daniel Pineda had in Bellator was a split decision to a young Emmanuel Sanchez. Breaking the news to you right now, Emmanuel Sanchez is going to rematch against Patricio Pitbull in their featherweight Grand Prix. It's going to be a hell of a fight. The first one was
one of the greatest fights
you'll ever see. All of that to say, Emmanuel Sanchez is one of Rufus Sport's top guys. And you might disagree with me and say Bellator is a lower league, whatever. Emmanuel Sanchez is a good fighter. Emmanuel Sanchez, really good fighter. So, Daniel Pineda, those two losses. You look at the win streak. All right, some of the guys that he beat after Bellator, maybe not the most well-known, but he's finished them. Then he comes into the PFL season. It was weird because it was late in the PFL season. They have him fight twice in one night near the end of the season. He beats Mavlid Khabibulayev, and he beats Jeremy Kennedy. And you might say, who's Mavlid Khabibulayev? You want to see a crazy fight? You want to see a man get killed in 14 seconds? Go watch Damon Jackson, Mavlid Khabibulayev. It's one of the craziest knockouts that PFL will shove down your throat. Then you look at the fight that he had against Junior Bacon Cheeseburger, Jeremy Kennedy, Canada's own. Let's pull out the flag. And he beat JBC at what JBC does. JBC is a great wrestler. He's a good grappler, and that's what he's going to go to bread and butter-wise. Daniel Pineda beat him at that. Then Pineda comes in and fights Herbert Burns. Herbert Burns is an accomplished grappler. He's a heavy striker. You saw that in his fight against Nate Landwehr. And Daniel Pineda absolutely wrecks him. Matt, I've talked a lot about Daniel Pineda early on, so let's get it out of the way. With Cub Swanson, he's 1-4 in his last five. But Matt, we have to talk about those losses because they're against some of the best guys that we've seen in this division in a long time.
I'm going to say this right now. Cub Swanson is just like Carlos Condit, Matt Brown to me. I'm not going to stand here and say bad things about Cub Swanson, but I'm about to say a few bad things about Cub Swanson. It's been a rough run for him, and I know he was on that bad losing streak as he pulled it up. He lost to Brian Ortega by submission. That was a beautiful submission by Brian Ortega, to be fair. That jumping guillotine, one of the nicer ones you'll ever see. Has that weird fight with Frankie Edgar. Of course, Edgar was coming off that quick turnaround after the Ortega loss that he had had. He beat breaks off poor Cub Swanson. Hinata Moicano, weird fight, because I thought, okay, that's one of the few fights Cub Swanson might have a chance to win. He was still sort of at the top of the division. It was very much what we like to say is a crossroads fight. Moicano dropped him with a jab and choked him in about a minute. So, not the best fight. And then the Shane Burgos one. I know it was a split decision, but if you know anything about MMA, that was a Chris Lee split decision if ever there was one. Shane Burgos put it on him. And that was the first fight where I was like, okay, I've never seen Cub Swanson really get outstruck. I saw Max Holloway outstrike him, but I know what I'm going to get from Max Holloway. Shane Burgos at the time, and even now, he's a very exciting guy. He's a very good boxer, and stylistically, he does match up against Swanson quite well. But it was the first time that we've ever seen Cub Swanson really lose his own game, and that's against a really heavy-handed guy who's going to throw the big hooks and long combinations. Because really, you would think, okay, if you're going to match up Cub Swanson with anyone, we might as well give him a primary boxer. And the fact that he couldn't get past that test, that's when he started to get a little worried. Then they matched him up with Crone Gracie, and honestly, that fight is more, it was definitely a little softball toss. A lot of people were high on Crone Gracie after he choked out Alex Caceres so fast, but that fight was so weird. It was fight of the night, it was a phenomenal fight, but you had Crone Gracie just jumping guard over and over and over again, and Cub Swanson beating him up on the feet. But there's another part of that fight people don't remember. Crone Gracie landed a ton of clean shots on Cub Swanson, and not that he hurt him, not that he ever had him in a bad position, but he ate a load of volume from Crone Gracie, and that worries me against a guy like Pineda, who can do a lot of the things that we've seen Cub Swanson struggle with. He does have the good wrestling, he's got the great top control, but also his striking isn't bad by any means, and I do think he could stifle some of the awkward and unorthodox movement of Cub Swanson.
The thing about that fight that Cub Swanson had against Crone Gracie, it was like Crone Gracie, instead of going to school with the Diaz brothers and any grappler that they had, the AJ Agazarms of the world, it's like they decided for a couple months, you know what, Crone, you're really good. Here's Chris Avila. Just teach Chris how to fight. Chris had a hard time against Pretty Boy Taylor. Just take Chris for a bit. And listen, in the promo and the lead up to that fight, I saw a lot of Chris Avila. I really did. So a little troubling. Shade on Chris. I'm just kidding, Chris. I know you don't like this anyway. But in that fight, Crone Gracie, yeah, kind of put it on him on the feet when he needed to. Mm. He had a weird stance because he's a grappler, so he stood really odd. I don't expect Pineda to strike like that whatsoever. I mean, that's a style that's going to be unique to a guy like Crone Gracie. So in this fight, it's a little bit more dynamic than that. As far as the notes that I did have on this one, It's the fact that you look at those losses and they're against the upper echelon of the division. Then you fight Chrome Gracie in a fight that Chrome Gracie was actually the favorite in that one. It was weird. Swanson gets the win. So in this fight, the odds are weird. So Cub Swanson opened up. This fight actually opened up as a pick'em, minus 110 for each. Cub Swanson right now, plus 124 average on best fight odds. Daniel Pineda, minus 149. If you look at the Tapology picks, they're just silly. They're absolutely silly. 796 total votes. You got 64% going Swanson. You got 85% going decision. What do you think about all that?
I disagree with a lot of it. Now, there is a point that I feel like has to be made. Cub Swanson not only is A, older than LeBron James, that guy's been a professional athlete since 2003, he's coming off an ACL and meniscus tear. And again, if you're a guy who's 24, you can overcome that injury and it's like it never happened.
Damn you, Jake Shields!
Exactly. Also, Quintet, that was a great event. They had done WEC versus Strikeforce versus UFC versus Pride. Check it out if you have Fight Pass. Gilbert Burns put on a show. But aside from that, Cub Swanson, yeah, he was grappling Jake Shields. Jake Shields kind of reaped the knee, and just, you know, next thing you know, Cub Swanson's being checked out by doctors, and it was worst case scenario. That really worries me. Like, you talk about a guy like Kevin Durant, who is one of the best athletes probably ever, coming off an Achilles injury. He's 31 years old, and people think he might never be the same again. Cub Swanson's over 37, coming off two major injuries in his knee, and he's a guy who relies on that explosiveness too, so it might hinder him worse than it does other fighters.
I'm 26, pop my knee backwards, and it's still every now and again when I step on something weird, flares right up and goes all the way back. All right, Durant. It freaks me the hell out. So that is a weird injury, though. And just from experience of, I would even say it was major at the time, relatively minor because it didn't require surgery. But just going through something like that, I can sympathize with him, because for him to have to go through the pain, the agony, the surgery, and the long time off, that straight up sucks. And the rehab process is terrible. So kudos to Cub Swanson for coming back in this one. For Daniel Pineda, now the favorite, the Tapology voters are against him. And I can see it. I mean, this is a legacy fighter from the WEC days and an all-timer in Cub Swanson. I look at Daniel Pineda, though, in his last fight against Herbert Burns. So if this fight's going to be a striking match, Pineda landed 173 of 205 total strikes for an 84% average. His significant strikes, 57 of 75 for 76%. His grappling was on fire. His wrestling was on fire. His striking was on fire. And that goes back to 4 or 5 years ago. This guy's on an absolute heater. His first run in the UFC ended years ago, and it was a bit of a surprise to see him back, especially because, and again, I talked about the JBC win and the win over Khabibulayev. They're no contest because he had elevated levels of testosterone. He was supposed to fight Lance Palmer in the finals of the PFL last year, but that fight fell out due to those issues, so insert Alex Gilpin for a third time. But Daniel Pineda, to me, has a lot more of the X factors at this point in his career, and it's weird to say that about a 45er at 35 years of age. I just like Daniel Pineda a lot more in this fight.
I agree. There's not a position more unpleasant to watch than the crucifix in MMA. You saw it with Daniel Cormier, Volkan Oezdemir, famous example. The amount of just concern that you see for the bottom fighter is really unmatched. And what Daniel Pineda was able to do against Herbert Burns, who I know they're going to bring up the fact that Cub Swanson is a black belt in jiu-jitsu. He's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. There's levels to that game, and Herbert Burns is a very legitimate world-class black belt. Daniel Pineda was able to MMA grapple and just beat the brakes off him the second the fight went to the mat. He used his wrestling. He has a really good top pressure, too. And that's something we do have to bring up. Top pressure is something that fighters won't really get credit for. It's like guys who set really good screens in basketball. Not really something that you get the credit for. It's not one of those like flashier stats, but it's a really important thing, because if you don't create the space, you're not susceptible to the submissions. You don't give your opponent room to move and, you know, get back up to their feet. So I like a lot of what Pineda is able to do on the mat. I love his ground and pound. I love his submission game. I think he'll be able to get the win over Cub Swanson.
Matt, if I can make a hockey reference, he's like a tough Hal Gillow.
He is.
Just setting things up. Big presence at 45. Matt, I'm going with Daniel Pineda in this fight too. I mean, I think there's definitely opportunities for him to finish the fight. Kudos to Cub Swanson. I mean, hell of a comeback, but overall, yeah, both going with Daniel Pineda in this one. Overall, Matt, great card. And we talk about 45ers here. We had a great fight at 55 in the co-main event. Tony Ferguson taking on the former 45er, Charles Oliveira. In our main event, Deiveson Figueiredo taking on a really tough out in the assassin, baby, Brandon Moreno. So, Matt, you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks as the week progresses. And as we always say, let's get into it. we get a big fight at heavyweight as the former heavyweight champ of the UFC, Junior Dos Santos, will be taking on Francis Cyril Gane, Le Bon Gamin. Matt, I'm really looking forward to this fight. I mean, I have been hooked on the Cyril Gane train since he got the win over Adam Dykstra here in, and I got to keep using the prop, in Canada with TKO. And Matt, in that fight, it was one of those ones where you got a guy out of MMA Factory that has a background in Muay Thai and kickboxing, representing MMA Factory in France. He's a main training partner of Francis Ngannou. Fernand Lopez, the coach there, really putting things together with a lot of prospects that I think you're going to see in the bigger leagues coming soon. And in that fight, he absolutely decimated Adam Dykstra. And Adam Dykstra was a once promising heavyweight prospect. It was looking like he was the guy that was going to come out of Canada. He had boxing aspirations too. Those fell apart. Cyril Gane absolutely derailed that train. So let's just throw our prayers together for Adam Dykstra. Maybe he gets his footing. But for Cyril Gane, you pick up that win. And I'm looking at his record here. The Dykstra win, the Roger Souza win. Then he comes into the UFC and he beats Rafael Pessoa. I wouldn't even say middling heavyweight. I'd say lower tier heavyweight. He beats him and submits him. And then he fights really tough out in Dontell Mays. Well, what does he do?
I don't know if I'd say real tough out.
Has a little bit of fun on the feet, takes him down, and in the dying seconds, submits him by heel hook. Matt, how often do we see heel hooks at heavyweight?
Never, actually. Like, ever at all. And that's really what makes Cyril Gane so unique. Like, every time he goes out there, you're going to see something that you never thought he was capable of. And I do like where he is in his career right now. He's only 6-0, but you can tell that there's so much potential and so much of a skill set that we haven't even seen yet.
Yeah, and you look at Cyril Gane in that fight, Matt. I remember us watching it in the moment. Matt went, why is he doing that? Like, it just seems like a weird submission. He's gonna, you know, Mays might get out of it and start pounding away at him. Not so. So in Cyril Gane's last fight, picks up a big win over Tanner Boser. And that was one of those fights where it really won me over. And here's the reason why. You might be down on Tanner Boser for the fight that he had against Andrei Arlovsky. And that's fine. Tanner Boser is a good heavyweight. And I don't have to say it because of the Canadian flag in my hand. Tanner Boser is a good fighter because he can do a lot of things well. He can throw with a lot of power, but normally he doesn't. He mixes in volume and his kicks, and he really just kind of takes over fights, stays on his bike. Well, Cyril Gane played that game. He beat Tanner Boser at that game. So if you can beat a power puncher boxer in Dontell Mays and submit him, you can beat Rafael Pessoa that, again, lower level heavyweight, but he has all the tools.
He gotta start somewhere.
And if you can beat Tanner Boser, who's a really good volume striker, his own game, what skill set can beat Cyril Gane? It's going to be awfully tough to beat him. And Matt, I've been quoted, and I'll continue to quote myself as saying, Cyril Gane, future champ. I really think Cyril Gane is going to go way up close to the top. And I think you're going to have Stipe Miocic, Cyril Gane, Curtis Blaydes, and Francis Ngannou for a long time until Stipe retires. And then you have two teammates in Gane and Ngannou, and you're going to end up with a Daniel Cormier, Cain Velasquez type situation where Cyril Gane, maybe he's the gatekeeper, and then Francis kind of does the old shake and bake Talladega Nights and let Cyril Gane be a champ for a little bit. Like, I don't know what's going to happen. I effing love this guy's skill set, and I've been on the train for a long time, so it's hard not to bring the bias into this fight. So let's talk about Junior Dos Santos a little bit. This is a guy that, Matt, when you and I get into MMA years ago,
oh my goodness,
he wasn't maybe right there, but he was on his way there, and then he got there, and then he's come down from there. And if we look at his last five fights, I know the Tai Tuivasa was one of the wins, and before that, after that, he beat Derek Lewis. Then after those two wins by finish, he's been finished three times in a row, and the last one really concerns me.
Yeah, so Junior Santos, we'll say post his suspension now. Junior Santos is one of the athletes who can actually point at USADA and tell them, hey, you actually cost me over a year of my career, because they came out and said they messed up his false drug test. Or not his false drug test, but his positive drug test.
Kind of like free agent Yoel Romero.
Exactly. It's been done before, and Junior Santos is one of those cases, and I feel like we do have to bring it up, because USADA has been brought up with his name, but it is no fault of his own. He did lose a significant chunk of his career after the Ben Rothwell fight. And it's unfortunate too, or not after the Ben Rothwell fight, after the Stipe fight. When he came back though, Blagoy even was a hard guy to look good against. He just kind of does everything well and he's super durable. He was able to come back. I'd say he put on, it was dominant, but it wasn't the most impressive showing over Blagoy. He had won every round quite handily, but still, he wasn't able to get him out of there. But it was a great sort of launching point, I guess, for the second half of Junior's career. And I say second half, he's on like his fifth segment now, if you will, because You gotta think, we had said, we started watching him as he was making his ascent towards the title. You forget how long he was at the top. Like, Junior Santos, for about 7 years, was 1 win away from a title shot. So, it's not like we're dealing with a guy who made his way to the top of the division, couldn't get over the elite, and then, you know, made a quick descent. He's been around for a while, and that is really the hard thing about Junior Santos when you're looking at his career. When you watch him fight, does he still move like he used to? He does. Does he still have hand speed? Of course he does. He has phenomenal boxing. The one thing, though, he can't take damage like he used to.
And let's throw another thing in there in the positives. Look up his Instagram page. I know that might sound silly, and you're going to get a lot of glamour shots, but this guy looks like $1 million at age 36. He's almost 37, a couple of months away from that. And I know he's got 3 losses in a row, but physically, he looks amazing. He looks shredded. You look at his weigh-in from his last fight, 238.5. That's great.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
We talked about that, especially in our earlier video, Sergey Spivak, Jared Vandera. Go back and watch it if you haven't already. But if you look at that fight, you got a way bigger heavyweight against a guy that, you know, he's in the 240s, 230s. In this fight, you've got Ciryl Gane, who last weighed in at 249. You got JDS at 238. This is like prime weight, especially in this division.
Two of the more athletic guys you're ever going to see at heavyweight. And I still feel like Junior at 36, almost 37, athletically speaking, is extremely explosive, has really good footwork. He does a lot of great things that is going to beat a lot of prospects. Like, if the UFC decided to put Junior Dos Santos in that Andrei Arlovsky category where it's like, okay, you're just the primary gatekeeper, Junior's going to knock out a lot of those guys. The difference is, it's just the amount of damage that he can take at this point. And I know we had said physically, even before the Jairzinho fight, he did look phenomenal. There was even talks people thought he might move down to 205. That's how shredded he looked. But he still has the same issue. He can throw shots, he can land, and if he lands, it's going to hurt you. But the problem is, if he is playing that kind of, I land a shot and I take a shot at the same time, there's not a lot of guys in the heavyweight division who aren't going to get to him before he gets to them. And you look at his recent losing streak, those are three of the better heavyweights you're ever going to get matched up against. The Derek Lewis fight was weird, and it is his last high-level win, so we do have to bring it up. And, of course, the fact that Derek Lewis is, he's not the number one contender, but he is in the top three right now, and Junior has a win over him. That was one of those weird Derek Alma back fights where he looked good, and then his back hurt, and then his stomach hurt. And there's always something with a Derek Lewis loss, but it was a weird fight for both guys. But I really did think after that, like, wow, Junior, if you don't knock out Derek Lewis, like, you're onto something. And then Francis knocked him out. And then Curtis Blaydes knocked him out. And that was the concerning fight because, of course, Curtis Blaydes, phenomenal fighter, but more well-known for his ground and pound. And the fact that he was able to rock Junior on the feet and finish him up against the cage, it was a little concerning. And then I think the Rozenstruik fight really just hammered home what we already knew. Rozenstruik laid it one clean shot that whole fight, and it just put down Junior. He landed that overhand left. And yes, Jairzinho is one of the more heavy-handed guys at heavyweight, but it was a shot that you knew that Junior in his prime would be able to take and keep going. Whereas now at this stage in his career, he does seem to get rocked by most of the clean shots that hit him. And against a guy like Ciryl Gane, that's not really the position you want
to
be in.
And to me, Ciryl Gane, I mean, A, knockout threat. But you look at the game that Ciryl Gane can play, and he's like a chameleon. If you want to have a grappling fight, well, let's go ahead. Let's do it. If we want to strike, we can strike. If we want a volume, we can. If you want to go into a power fight, let's do it. Ciryl Gane can do so many different things really well, and you don't ever see that with a fighter that's 6-0. You also don't see 6-0 fighters fighting a guy with 29 pro fights and a heavyweight strap on his mantle. You never see this. This guy's such a special talent that if we look at the odds, paper notes, Ciryl Gane opened as a minus 270 favorite. Le Bon Gamay maintenant a minus 424 favorite. For JDS, open plus 230. He's now plus 319. Underdog over on Tapology. Let's go with the recent ones. We got him in front of us. 881 total votes. 81% with Ciryl Gane. 75% have him to win by knockout. Do you think JDS get knocked out 4 fights in a row?
I do. Okay, I'm going to disagree with one thing you said about the Ciryl Gane ground game. I don't think he can take down Junior Dos Santos. That's going to be the one thing I don't think he can do.
Wouldn't it be cool if he did?
It would be, but Cain Velasquez could barely do it, so I have a really hard time believing that Ciryl Gane's going to be able to take Junior down. Junior has some of the best takedown defense, really, in the division's history, and he's great at making people pay for those takedown attempts. He didn't have a lot of success in the Blaydes fight, but when he did, it was when Blaydes would be shooting for the takedown, really overextending with his hands, and Junior's got that great uppercut in the middle. I know the results aren't the same that it used to be from when he landed those shots. If go back to the Fabricio Verdum fight, Junior Santos' UFC debut, he lands that one shot that basically just separates like Verdum's soul from his body. That's how violent it was. I don't think Ciryl Gane is going to be able to go out there and really out-grapple Junior Santos. I think Junior Santos has one thing that's going to give Ciryl Gane problems. And of course, I don't know if you've noticed, we're leaning pretty heavy Ciryl Gane right now. The leg kicks to Gerardo Santos are something that doesn't get enough credit. In the Miocic fight, he was landing that low calf kick over and over and over again. And it did start to give Stipe trouble. And then, of course, Stipe just kind of bum-rushed him and knocked him out against the cage. But if JDS is really committed to that leg kicking plan, he might be able to slow down sort of that stalking movement of Ciryl Gane. But again, it's really hard to pick against one of the more exciting prospects and more well-rounded prospects we've had at heavyweight for a while.
I gotta defend myself slightly, Matt. When I said Ciryl Gane, if you want to grapple, let's grapple. If you want to wrestle, let's wrestle. Vice versa, whatever. He can do it.
Can.
I don't expect him to do it
in this
fight. No, I don't expect him to do it at all. GDS over his UFC career, incredibly lengthy, 81% takedown defense. Yeah, it's not going to happen with Ciryl Gane. The fight's going to take place on the feet. Ciryl Gane, his striking defense so far, 73%, and I mean, that's a small sample size against a couple of lower tier guys and Tanner Boser. And then you look at the strike differential, it's great. Like, we're talking a very, very high differential for Gane. He just has that fight IQ. You can tell it's there. And I wouldn't even say, because he's not like a raw prospect at 6-0. He's pretty well a finished product, and he has all those different tools in his tool belt. I like him in this fight. Again, Junior Dos Santos, what do you have to worry about? The power and the kicks. And if he's able to land, you never know. He could put out Ciryl Gane. It's a heavyweight fight. Anything can happen. But I will side relatively heavily with Francis Ciryl Gane in this one.
I'm going to be really sad if JDS gets KO'd, but that's probably how the fight's going to go. Again, you're dealing with a guy who can't take damage all that well against a guy who's really good at dishing it out. So it's hard to pick against Ciryl Gane in this one.
Matt, both of us going with Francis Ciryl Gane, and really looking forward to this card. We have a great main event between Deiveson Figueiredo and Brandon Moreno for flyweight gold. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
To be totally honest with you, Mike Grundy doesn't have a lot of good quotables from Oklahoma State, but the one that still sticks out and resonates to this day is, "I'm a man! I'm 40!
I'm a man! I'm 40!
And Matt, in this fight, Jacare Souza, for now, is 40, but when the fight takes place, he's going to be 41, or I guess as we record this, he's still 40, so we can still use the Mike Grundy quotable. He's going to be taking on the much younger man in Kevin Holland, who's coming in on short notice, replacing Marvin Vettori, and there's so many different layers to this fight. I mean, the fact that Kevin Holland, I mean, listen, this guy's fought, it seems like, every other weekend, and so far in 2020, we look at the wins. I mean, Anthony Hernandez, Joaquin Buckley, then he fights Darren Stewart, beats him in a split decision, then he beats Charlie Ontiveros. Has anybody checked in on Charlie Ontiveros to see if he's
weird
all right?
Fight, but Kevin Holland was winning up until the point that Ontiveros got hurt, but it was a weird fight.
It was a weird fight, and Ontiveros with his crusty clown hair, it was just way too weird of a call-up. So let's call a spade a spade. Some of Kevin Holland's wins are weird, but so are his losses. I mean, you look at the Brendan Allen loss, he had him cracked, he had him bleeding, and then they kind of tussled a little bit in the second round, and Brendan Allen submits him. The other loss, a short-notice call-up into the UFC at 205 against Thiago Santos, in a fight where Kevin Holland took every ounce of punishment that Santos could give at him, and he didn't give up.
Talk shit back to him, actually. It was the exact opposite. Kevin Holland is a really weird fighter, and of course, we have to mention he was supposed to be fighting Jack Hermanson on last weekend's card, but then got taken off due to a positive COVID test, and now fighting Jacare. So hopefully everything's good now. Hopefully we get the same version of Kevin Holland that we kind of know and love. And Holland has been one of those, he's not a Sean O'Malley prospect, but he's definitely more hyped up than your regular prospect. And of course, this matchup, and of course, the main event last weekend shows that. Kevin Holland, at the start of his career, I wasn't sold on him. I can be very open about that. He's a rangy striker. He talked a lot of crap, but he never really backed it up all that well. And after the run that he's been on, you can say what you want about some of the fighters who he has beaten, but I do think you have to look at the performance and not always just the opponent. And the fact that Kevin Holland's going out there and basically he can out-grapple you, he can out-strike you. I really like his striking too, because he's not a guy who's going to throw those big looping shots like we had seen from Jack Hermanson. When Hermanson got tired, he was kind of throwing those slapping punches. With Kevin Holland, he keeps everything very down the middle, very straight, very good at using his range too. He is going to catch you at the end of his shots. He's not going to give you any extra space that you don't deserve. And I think against a guy like Jacare, who is very leg kick heavy and very wrestling heavy, that's going to be a huge advantage for Holland.
With Kevin Holland too, we talk about it a lot with Fight Night Picks. The guy's got a lot of whip at the end of his shots, but Kevin Holland is one of those fighters.
Oh, yeah.
And he's so unorthodox and fluid in his striking as well. The other thing that you have to be careful of, and Jacare doesn't, but most people do, Kevin Holland, a black belt in jiu-jitsu, under Travis Luter, which you might think, I remember that guy, like, right? Like,
didn't he get submitted by Anderson Silva?
Well, he did, but he is definitely one of those under-the-radar, low-key, really good coaches out there. And he's really mentored Kevin Holland in a great way. Holland coming into the biggest fight of his career and going from Auntie Veros, who was a career welterweight, taking a fight at middleweight on short notice and got wrecked, to Jacare Souza, Strikeforce Elite. Now, I get it. Jacare in his last five fights hasn't been the best run, but it's been a weird run. He beats Derek Brunson and finishes him, and I'll come back to that one. Loses a split decision to Kelvin Gastelum, beats Chris Weidman, loses to Jack Hermanson decision, and then loses a split decision to Jan Blachowicz at 205 pounds. You can see it from the graphic that's going to come up. I have him listed as 205 and then an asterisk because that was his last weigh-in. Coming back down to middleweight, there's a lot of weird things for me for Jacare in this fight. One, he tried out 205 and didn't like it, so now he's back at middleweight. Why? It's weird to be this late in your career to do that. Jacare training out of, what's it called? Jacare BJJ?
It's Souza a personalized BJJ? Gym.
But it's kind of like his gym. Kind of like Tony Ferguson or co-main event from Snapdown. But that's another weird thing. Jacare's bounced around from camps. He's done the Fusion XL. Matt Skroy, former, you know, minor league fighter in hockey. He coaches there. But it's just one of those ones where late in his career, he's kind of gone to Florida. He's found some success. He had that win against Derek Brunson, so I'd like to talk about that just quickly because that was, like, supposed to be Brunson's coming out party. It was at home. It was in the main event. Jacare beat the piss out of him.
In his hometown, too, which was the worst part. And it was a rematch. Of course, people remember Jacare knocked him out back in Strikeforce, but it was a very different Derek Brunson than the first time they fought. And Jacare was having none of it. He basically marched him down like a Terminator, kicked him in the head, and beat him up with some really nice ground and pound. It was a phenomenal performance, but I do think that was the last time we saw Jacare. Like, we've seen Ronaldo Souza out there a few times since then, but we haven't seen the same Jacare. And the first performance that made me a little concerned for Jacare at middleweight was the Robert Whittaker one. And a lot of people remember that fight. That was Robert Whittaker's coming out party. A lot of people like to point to the first Yoel fight, but he wouldn't have got that first Yoel fight for the title if he didn't knock out Jacare Souza. And in that fight, it was very odd because Souza, you know what you're going to get. He's probably the bet. Well, he's in that top five kind of S tier, if you will, jiu-jitsu practitioners in MMA. Robert Whittaker just threw him off his back, beat him up on the feet really, really bad, and the speed was a problem for Jacare, and I do think that's been the story of his career. If Jacare hits you, you are going down. He's super heavy-handed. He has very developed striking for a guy who is a BJJ ace from a lot of the guys we talk about a lot. They're those big looping shots. Jacare throws the looping shots, but he is very technical with them. He likes that left hook to the body, too. We see that a lot. We saw that a lot in the Chris Weidman fight, of course. The problem with some of those techniques are they leave him open to get hit, and he's been rocked a lot lately. Jack Hermanson was able to rock him. Jan Blachowicz rocked him. Chris Weidman was. Kelvin Gastelum also dropped him. He's had this sort of weird secondary part of his career. I'll just say sort of the back nine, if you will, where he can't take shots the same way that he used to be able to, but he still fights in the same way that he did, where he is open to eating damage. And that concerns me against a guy like Kevin Holland. You are going to have to close the range at a certain point against Holland, and you're going to be walking through a lot of those dangerous straight shots, the kicks of Holland, the knees of Holland. You just have to get through a lot of those weapons before you can go to take Kevin Holland to the ground. Because I don't expect Jacare Souza to try to stand with Kevin Holland for 15 minutes. I think if Brennan Allen could submit Kevin Holland, and nothing against Kevin Holland's grappling, I do think he's a phenomenal grappler, but if Brennan Allen, who is a very physical grappler, can get to Kevin Holland on the ground, I assume Jacare Souza would be able to as well. Jacare, I think he's going to be more grapple-heavy in this fight than we have seen him for a very long time. I know in the Chris Weidman fight, that did sort of devolve into one of those, well, we're both really good at grappling, let's strike for 15 minutes fights. But you go to the Jan Blachowicz fight, there just wasn't a lot of activity. It was a lot of Jacare following Blachowicz around the cage. He would try to use his boxing, but he would never really commit to it. Because when he did, Blachowicz would hit him with a couple quick shots, get his back off the cage, and then it was just kind of rinse and repeat for 25 minutes. So Jacare was rewarded for his cage presence in that fight, whereas I don't really think he fought all that well in that fight. I know it's a weird distinction to make, but I do think that's an important point to bring up.
And it's funny because, you know, there's going to be a lot of people out there, and feel free to comment this if you want, but he just lost a split decision to your now champ at 205, so he's going to beat Kevin Holland, right? Well, Kevin Holland right now is the favorite in this one. He opened a minus 175. He's now minus 135 average on best fight odds. So the money is coming in on Jacare, who opened a plus 135. He's now at a plus 110. If we look at the total Tapology votes, Matt, 805 total. 68% going with Holland, 54% having to win by decision, 37% of the voters having to win by knockout. It's a tricky one because Jacare in his last fight, really chasing Blahovic, really pushing him up in, against the cage, not really doing a whole lot. He won on cage presence, and that's probably how he got some of the votes and some of the, you know, the judges on his side. But overall, wasn't a very impressive performance.
No, it does look like age has caught up to Jacare. We're not really seeing the same fighter that we did see fight to a split decision with Yoel Romero that a lot of people thought he won. Or the same fighter that did fight Luke Rockhold all the way back in Strikeforce. Like,
Jacare's... I thought he beat Kellen Gastelum not that long
exactly.
ago.
And that fight wasn't that long ago. Or at least in your memory it wasn't. It's just the fact that Jacare hasn't been all that consistent in the cage as of late. He has been taking quite a bit of time off in between fights. I mean, geez, it's been a year since his last fight. All those signs aren't very promising, but I'm going to do a bit of a wild card. All week long, all day long, I've been thinking Kevin Holland's going to win this fight, but I really do believe if Jacare goes out there with that wrestling-heavy game plan, if he goes out there with a more grappling mindset, I think he can win this fight. Not only do I think he can win this fight, I'm actually going to make that my official prediction. I think if Jacare goes out there and uses wrestling, the wrestling's something that Jacare doesn't get enough credit for. He is one of the better jiu-jitsu aces in the wrestling department. I know that's the thing that a lot of jiu-jitsu practitioners, they're not great at the wrestling. It is the transition that they struggle with. But with Jacare, he has really good head and arm throws. He has good wrestling himself. And with a guy like Kevin Holland, I can see Jacare overpowering him, especially early on in the fight. And once the fight does hit the mat, I mean, Jacare is going to go through most guys like warm knife through butter. So I am going to pick Jacare, although not a confident pick. And for the division's sake, I kind of hope Kevin Holland wins.
This seems like one of those trap card type of fights where Kevin Holland is expected to win. He's on a win streak. He's a young guy. He's exciting. And then Jacare goes out there and takes the wind out of sails. And I feel the same way about this fight. Because if you look at the win streak Kevin Holland's on, Anthony Hernandez, what kind of a ripple has he caused in middleweight since coming in off Contender Series? Nothing. Joaquin Buckley. Okay. That's an outlier. But Buckley was coming in on incredibly short notice. And he put on a good account of himself in that fight, even though he got finished. Darren Stewart is a good wrestler. Holland won that fight by split decision. That's 2 months ago. And then he fights a month ago against Charlie Ontiveros. And Ontiveros gets hurt. And he's not even UFC caliber fighting up a weight class. So for Holland, the things that I don't like, the level of competition, the struggle against Darren Stewart, and then the fact that, again, say what you will about the layoff, I guess, that he's on right now. But he was originally supposed to take on Jack Hermanson in a 5-round fight. Albeit on short notice, but that was the fight he was scheduled for. What are you going to get ready for with Jack Hermanson? I know Hermanson beat Souza. Let's not play MMA math. But if you get 100% Jack Hermanson, doesn't have a broken orbital or a broken toe, what do you have to plan for?
You got to plan for the kicks, the output, and the wrestling. And the weird thing, though, is you don't really have to get ready for the same type of grappling that Jacare is going to bring to the table. Jack Hermanson is a phenomenal grappler, but you're dealing with someone who, if you play a lot of 2K, there's gold badges and then there's Hall of Fame badges. And Jacare's got himself a Hall of Fame badge in jiu-jitsu, where that most guys, really in the UFC, have Jacare's forgot more about jiu-jitsu than Kevin Holland probably knows. And I feel comfortable saying that. Like, that's the level of grappling that we're dealing with a guy like Jacare.
So for Jacare, you have the power wrestling. He's the type of guy that can work a double leg, work you up against the cage, especially at 85, less so at 205, especially against a guy like Blahovic. So for Jacare, a lot of things that I actually strangely like in this fight. Listen, age is going to come into it, and I'm going to have to wait until these guys step on the scale before I can really make the final nail in the coffin official prediction. But right now, yeah, I'm going with the underdog, oddly enough, in Jacare Souza to get the win. We're both in agreement on this one. Let us know what you're thinking below in the comments section. Have we lost our minds? Are we absolutely insane? We're perhaps both going with Jacare Souza. Really looking forward to this card. We have a fellow Brazilian in the main event, Deiveson Figueiredo, taking on Brandon Moreno for that flyweight gold. So, as we always say with Fight Night Picks, Matt, let's get into it. Really looking forward to our next fight coming up at lightweight. Yes, I said lightweight. We have Renato Moicano, the former standout at featherweight, taking on one of the most dynamic strikers you're going to find in all of MMA, and Kyrgyzstan's Rafael Fiziev. Adam Man is the nickname, and this guy is an atom bomb in the cage. That was a terrible dad joke. I apologize for it. I'm only 26 years old. But I look at this fight, and it's very, very much a clash of styles, because Renato Moicano, long-rangey striker, a guy that can mix in a tidy little clinch game. He's got really good submissions, too, once the fight hits the mat. For Rafael Fiziev, this is a guy coaches at Tiger Muay Thai. And Matt, when I talk about a coach from Tiger Muay Thai, a lot of people are going to go, well, automatically Brad Riddell. Fazeev was his replacement. So it's kind of funny there. Both of those guys took on Magomed Mustafayev. For Fazeev, it was his first career loss in his first UFC fight. For Brad Riddell, he ended up picking a win up against Mustafayev in one of the better fights you're ever going to see. So for Fazeev, he comes back. He has a fight against Alex White, wins a decision. Then he wins a decision over Mark Giacchese.
What a fight.
Kind of glossed over those. Fight of the night against Mark Giacchese in an all-timer. And a good fight against Alex White where Fazeev, man, what does this guy do? Awesome hooks. He has some of the fastest hands you're going to find in MMA because a lot of guys throw a lot of the power hooks. You can see it coming on television from a mile away, but of course in the cage you can't. This guy has crazy speed. He has a lot of power. Hasn't really translated into any knockdowns so far, but you can tell Alex White took so much punishment in their fight. I was surprised one of the judges scored at 29-28, but maybe it was just for heart alone in one of the rounds for Alex White. White went 0 of 11 for takedowns. Mark Giacchese went 0 of 4 for takedowns in his fight. So far, Fazeev has 100% takedown defense in the UFC. And I looked at that stat without doing any of the research. The first thing I did was go on UFC stats and go 100% takedown defense. So somebody's gone for one, and that's about it. No, Fazeev's got pretty good takedown defense, especially for a striker. You watch the way that he defends some of these takedowns. For Alex White, he was going for the single legs. Fazeev kind of posts up and kind of sticks back a little bit and really does a good job of staying out of the way, really distributes his weight well on those takedown attempts, and does a good job of keeping himself standing. When it's in the clinch, he does not like to have his back up against the cage, and he pushes off really well. This fight against Moicano, though, it's really tricky because it's a huge step up in competition.
It really is, and I do think this fight comes down to a lot of like in-betweeners. You can't really just look at the striking of both guys. You can't just look at the grappling of both guys. I do like what you brought up about the clinch work, especially with Fazeev with his back against the cage. That's one of Moicano's best positions. If he can get that really high Muay Thai clinch, it is weird too. With Moicano being the one coming up a weight class, he is a big guy at lightweight. Just frame-wise, he is really hard to deal with. He's sort of built like a welterweight almost. He's just sort of one of those tall, thin guys. And what you like about Moicano too, and what I always like with guys moving up in weight, he looked good in his first fight at 155. He is going to look even better in his second fight at 155 because it does take your body a little time to adjust. You sort of become a lightweight. You don't just become a featherweight who's not cutting weight anymore. And I think that's currently the process that Renato Moicano is undergoing. It's a very much a style clash because Fazeev, does he have the power? Of course he does. Does he have the long-ranging hooks? Does he have the explosiveness? He has all those things. With Moicano, he just does the basics really, really well. You look at his boxing, he throws really nice straight shots down the middle. He has really nice kicks too. He does hold his chin a little high, which is somewhat concerning. We've seen that cost him in past fights. But it is hard to take a lot from the Aldo and Korean Zombie losses, in my opinion, and apply that to Fazeev. Just because Jose Aldo is one of the greatest strikers really ever in MMA, and that stoppage was a little early. For me, it was. Maybe you thought it was just, but it was slightly early of a stoppage. Korean Zombie put him down, but if you hear Korean Zombie actually talk about what he did, he sort of planned all that out perfectly, which is just, I think that's more of a compliment to how good the Zombie is. And Moicano, I like the Calvin Kattar performance. It's the one that I always go back to. I know that was a few years ago, and Kattar's improved quite a bit, but at the time, it was just, these are these two really exciting young prospects. Let's match them up and see what happens. And that fight was not competitive in the least bit. And I know a lot of people in hindsight are probably thinking, well, goodness, did Calvin Kattar knock him out? Not at all. Renato Moicano, calf kicks for days. He really bothered Calvin Kattar, threw a ton of calf kicks, threw a ton of just kicks in general, and kept the fight at his range. And when we talk about those X factors, I think range is the first thing that we have to bring up. Because for Fazeev to win this fight, he's going to have to get on the inside, use his hooks, and really use his physicality to oppose on Moicano. Where if you're Moicano, you have to use your footwork, you have to stick to the jab, and you really have to stay on your bike for the majority of the fight. Now, one thing I do love from Moicano is his output. And the weird thing about him, too, is probably the best example of his output is in a loss. The Brian Ortega fight, he never stopped throwing. And Brian Ortega, we know how good his boxing is. He was right in there with him in the pocket through a lot of those exchanges. And really, Moicano was winning that fight up until he went for one of the dumbest takedowns ever. But if he goes for that takedown on a guy like Fazeev, yes, Fazeev might defend it. He might, you know, get taken down. Moicano on the mat against anyone not named Brian Ortega is giving people a ton of issues. He is phenomenal at jiu-jitsu.
In my brain, I look at Renato Moicano's last win over Demir Hadzevich, and Demir Hadzevich is a good fighter. I mean, his UFC run's been Yeah, he's kind of like the, I don't know,
he's Marcin Held before Marcin Held came to the UFC.
He's kind of like the shredded wheat. You know, you like to eat shredded wheat for breakfast. It's all right, but sometimes you have the Oreo cereal. You have the weird sugary stuff. You like that.
The Reese's one.
Shredded wheat, it's all right. Demir Hadzovic, so it's a good win. I mean, it was a quick win. It was done in over a minute. Renato Moicano submits him. For me, I have a look over on the YouTube. So we put it out there in the YouTube community for a vote today. So this was only in 6 hours. 368 total votes. 60% of voters going with Fazeev to 40% going with Renato Moicano. Let's have a quick look over on Tapology. Tapology votes are different. 826, 61% going with Moicano. 46% saying he's going to get the win by submission. It's interesting because, again, Matt, you bring up a really good example. You look at Renato Moicano, and we talked about this kind of off-camera earlier on in the day when we were talking about our picks. There's two fights that Renato Moicano has where he has a ton of success against fighters that are relatively similar to Fazeev. In relative terms, the win over Calvin Kattar and the win over Jeremy Stephens. Jeremy Stephens a little bit more so. Compact striker, really likes to throw with a lot of power, throws good kicks. Jeremy Stephens. Renato Moicano beats him by split decision, incorporates the takedown, overall out-volumes him in that one. Then you look at the win that he has over Calvin Kattar. It's a masterclass. But then he has two losses against primary strikers that like to throw that thunder in the pocket in Jose Aldo and Korean Zombie. Again, all-timers. I mean, everybody loves Korean Zombie except for everybody he's fought. And for Jose Aldo, I don't know why they don't put him in GOAT conversation, but the guy's a GOAT at featherweight.
Craig, they do. Like, he's widely considered. I think Jose Aldo is, like, the fifth best fighter ever. Like, he's not on my Mount Rushmore, but if I ever decide that I'm going to add a fifth face to it, he would be the face I add.
Xiaoqiu Yan tried to pummel him out of there, but he's still up there for me. So, sad. Overall, I look at those two fights, and they worry me a little bit now. For Renato Moicano, took a lot of time off between the Korean Zombie fight and the Demir Hadzovic fight. Almost a year, and he picked up a really quick win. What can I learn from that? Not a lot. I mean, Demir Hadzovic, a good fighter, don't get me wrong. So is Fazeev. Fazeev's still early on in his MMA career. This guy has a Sambo background, training at a Tiger Muay Thai. He's really a jack of all trades, but it is that striking that's so good. And again, they're two different strikers. Moicano's got to work from distance if he's going to get a win. Fazeev's got to be able to crash that distance, land with a lot of firepower, which we've seen him do in the Alex White fight and in the fight against Jacasey. So it is a tricky one to try and predict. It is.
Oh, 100%. Now, here's the thing I really like about Moicano. He's not only fought guys better than Fazeev, he's beaten them. Now, has he lost to those fighters as well? He has. But that's going to happen when your name's at the top of a division. And Moicano's a bit of a victim of how good he is. After that Jeremy Stephens win, because he beat Stephens early on in his UFC career, from that moment on, you knew he was never going to get an easy fight again. And just going through the list, Brian Ortega, Calvin Kattar, Cub Swanson, Jose Aldo, Korean Zombie. That was his run at featherweight after he fought Jeremy Stephens. Those are all, if not, well, at one point other than Cub Swanson, those are all guys who could fight for the title at any given day. And with Aldo, he's one of the greatest fighters ever. So the level of competition for Renato Moicano has definitely been there, and he's a far better grappler than Alex White or Mark Jacasey. And I really like Renato Moicano in this fight. He's the underdog. I like his range. I like his jiu-jitsu. I'm actually really looking forward to Renato Moicano's future at 155
so
pounds.
So let's talk about those odds, Matt. Paper notes. Renato Moicano opened up as a minus 105, just a slight underdog. He's now plus 128 for Fazeev. He's now at a minus 155, open as a minus 115. Over on Tapology, we talked about the votes. The voters on Tapology going with Moicano. The Fight Night Picks fans are going with Fazeev. I know that there's going to be a big skirmish down below in the comments, so let us know who you're going with. But Matt, that's the thing. Fazeev hasn't fought that same level of competition in MMA. We know he's a Muay Thai god. We know how good he is at Sambo, which is a great base to have, especially in a fight like this. And having that takedown defense, I like it. Now, Alex White isn't on the same level as Moicano. Alex White isn't on the same level as even Mark Jacasey, so it's tough to really gauge what you're going to get. The one thing that I've noticed in a lot of the fights that Fazeev has had against different guys is the fact that the corners are always saying, we'll just throw straight shots up the middle. It's a lot easier said than done against a guy like Fazeev. So to me, this is one of the tougher fights to try and predict. I will slightly side with you in this one. I'm going with Renato Moicano as the underdog in this fight because, again, I've seen it against the highest level of competition. Now, granted, he's been finished. So you look at the fights, fight of the night against Brian Ortega, he gets submitted. He had a performance of the night, win over Cub Swanson, where he finishes him in the first round. The Aldo fight's tough. The Korean Zombie fight is also tough. You know what's weird? That was a main event. That's one of those cheap sign posters you can buy on the UFC's website because nobody cares. But overall, it's tricky, but I'm going to side with Moicano. And again, this is the one thing that I want to know from you. If Moicano is going to get a win over Fazeev, how is he going to do it?
Okay. There's actually quite a few ways, and that's the good news. Moicano can just stick the jab out there, stay on his bike, and probably win a decision that way. Now, he doesn't really fight in that style. He's a little bit more aggressive than that. I really like the range that he will be able to keep, though, throughout this fight. Whether it is the boxing range, Renato Moicano's boxing range is almost at Fazeev's kicking range. And I really like that for Moicano because the lacking striking defense that he does have will at least be a little bit fixed due to the fact that he's going to be able to stand at such a range from Fazeev. Fazeev could land one of those big looping shots as Moicano's sort of moving backwards with his chin up in the air. I just don't see it happening. And again, I'm not going to say that Renato Moicano is going to be a top 155er for his whole career, but I do think he's going to give a lot of guys at lightweight a really hard fight.
So Matt, we're both going with Renato Moicano in this fight. Both guy definitely has an opportunity to get the win and skyrocket themselves into that top 20 to 15 range with a win. And overall, Matt, really looking forward to our co-main event. Tony Ferguson taking on Charles Oliveira in the main event. Deiveson Figueiredo taking on a really tough out in the assassin, baby, Brandon Moreno. So you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. Matt, all thanks to the fans out there. Support for Fight Night Picks is now brought to you by Manscaped. Who is the best in men's below-the-waist grooming? Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. And Matt, I couldn't be more excited about this. Honestly, you probably saw it earlier with our Fight in the Night picks to start off the card, but I'm really excited to have Manscaped on board. And I mean, they make some great products. And listen, we've all been there. I have bought the generic trimmer that you buy from the big box store, brought it home, and I had a nose hair trimmer. And to be totally honest, I have a nose hair problem. I'll admit it here on the internet in front of thousands of people. I have nose hair issues. And I had one of those ones with the blades on the side. And you get it in there, it hurts. It's not fun to use. You're using that trimmer. It doesn't work very good in the shower. You can't see what you're doing. And then all of a sudden, you're trying to get in real high and tight. And you nick your nuts. And then it's a problem. And it looks really bad in the shower for the next person that has to hop in the shower. If you don't clean it up, it's just a mess. I have to tell you, though, that's why Manscaped, they redesigned the electric trimmer. Now, Matt, if you go with the perfect package combo, you got the Manscaped boxer briefs. It's great stuff. You get the Manscaped shirt that Matt has on. You get a great little carrying case. You need a nice toiletry bag. They got one. It's nice, and it's leather. But if you look inside, this is where it really gets neat. And they've redesigned that electric trimmer. The Manscaped engineering team has perfected the greatest ball hair trimmer ever created. I talked about it, but they just released the new and improved Lawnmower 3.0. Look at that light there, Matt. Ceramic. It's great. Their third generation trimmer features a cutting edge ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents. And when I tell you this is premium, I do mean premium. The battery will last up to 90 minutes so you can take a longer shave. The waterproof technology allows you to groom the shower like Craig Allen does. You know, another important part of my life, apparently. And one of the coolest features is that LED light, which illuminates grooming areas for a closer and more precise trimming. They've also upgraded to a 7,000 RPM motor with quiet stroke technology. And let's not forget about that charging stand. Listen, you have friends or relatives over on a Skype or Zoom call. You're leading them through your house. You're saying, hey, look at how clean my bathroom is. Wow! You hit them with the Manscaped, and they're going to respect you for that one. Overall, you can show off your trimmer loud and proud because it is an intelligently designed stand, convenient charging dock powered by USB. You got the USB charger at home. I know you do. And if you get the perfect package combo, it's going to come with that as well. And if you're listening to me speak right now, I want you to experience this firsthand for yourself. Let's get that bush and tush clean. Get 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. Make your testies your besties. Matt, I know we both got these packages. We tried them out because you're not going to talk about something that you haven't tried. No word of a lie. Best thing I have in my grooming arsenal. And again, I talked about the nose hair trimmer. Let's pull this bad boy out. If you get the perfect package combo, it comes with the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. It's a salve. It works very nice. It keeps you nice and I said high and tight, but it keeps you high and tight all day. But the Crop Reviver Ball Toner, spritz a little bit of that on. You're going to feel nice and cool for a little while. It works very good, keeps things nice and clean. And I talked about it, but the Weed Whacker, Matt, this nose hair trimmer, look it up, go to manscaped.com, use that promo code FNP so they know that we sent you. You're going to get 20% off your order and free shipping. It's at manscaped.com. Promo code FNP. Your balls will thank you. Big time fight coming up at lightweight in our co-main event, UFC 256. We have El Cocoy making his return. Unsuccessful interim title bid back this past spring against Justin Gaethje, looking to take on one of the most dangerous dual threats, really, that we have in the UFC in Charles Do Bronx Oliveira. Matt, we talk about Charles Oliveira. He holds the UFC's submission record. And you look at the tidy little win streak that he's got going on since the tail end of 2017 when he lost to Paul Felder. He has wins over Clay Guida by first-round guillotine, Christos Yagos, second-round rear naked. He's got a win over Jim Miller, first-round rear naked choke, David Taymor, Anaconda, Nick Lentz, Jared Gordon, and Kevin Lee at the start of this year. Now, he's had a couple of different fights fall through, namely the Beneil Dariush fight back just a couple of months ago. But he's taken this fight against Tony Ferguson, and this is arguably the biggest fight of Charles Oliveira's career. And I know he's fought Max Holloway, he's fought Anthony Pettis and Lamas and Felder, but this is a huge fight. And Frank Yeager and Cub Swanson and Cowboy Cerrone, he really has fought a who's who since he came into the UFC. And if you're not aware, Charles Oliveira has been in the UFC since 2010. His debut, a first-round armbar over Darren Elkins. Those guys have really been around for a really long time. And Matt, I can't underscore Tony Ferguson's win-loss record. The fact that he went on an unbeaten streak for about 8 years, lost to Michael Johnson, and then just went on a crazy run, ended it this past spring against Justin Gaethje. There's almost nothing that this guy can't do. And it's crazy the amount of damage that he took in that fight against Justin Gaethje, but he just kept coming. I mean, he was like, I don't know, the Terminator.
He's almost like he's El Cocuy, his nickname.
Oh, boy.
He is the Mexican boogeyman, pretty much. And you look at what Tony Ferguson does well, it's everything. He doesn't have a massive weakness to his game. Is he hittable? Yes, he is. But here's the good news. Charles Oliveira is one of the few top lightweights who isn't going to really make him pay for that. And I don't mean that to really insult the striking of Charles Oliveira. He's become so much better of a striker than what he used to be. But power isn't the key to his game. He really likes to set up his shots. He relies more on the accuracy of his punches than he does the force behind them. So I do think Tony Ferguson, in that respect, this is a good stylistic matchup for him. On the reverse, this might be the first time Tony Ferguson's ever fought a guy who has better jiu-jitsu than himself. And I'm curious to see how he deals with that, because Anthony Pettis, for instance, is a great grappler. But the second they were on the mat, Tony Ferguson started threatening with a leg lock immediately, and then he was throwing elbows off his back. That's good against a guy like Anthony Pettis. You can get away with that. With Charles Oliveira, the only real weakness he has in his grappling is sometimes he leaves his head out when he goes for takedowns. Anthony Pettis is able to take advantage of that. Ricardo Lamas is able to take advantage of that. And it is weird, too, that we talk about Charles Oliveira. He has the most submissions in UFC history. He's arguably the number one jiu-jitsu practitioner in the sport right now, or at least he uses it in his game the most. He's been submitted a few times himself. Now, I don't think Tony Ferguson is going to submit Charles Oliveira. That is my most unlikely outcome for this fight. But just something to consider, that when you're dealing with two guys who are very grappling heavy, I do think both guys could submit each other. And again, I don't really see it happening, because I do think both guys' defense are at a great level. It's just really interesting that we're dealing with two grapplers at such a high level, but they can also do everything else.
Yeah, and I mean, for Charles Oliveira, maybe that name recognition isn't totally there. I mean, he got the win back over Jim Miller in that win streak. Not really close to the same level fighter Tony Ferguson took on, except for one being the common opponent of Kevin Lee, future champ, and I mean, great head tattoo too.
It's not looking great, you say a future champ right now.
This fight here, Matt, is so interesting, because we can talk about the striking. The fact that I would argue Tony Ferguson, better striker, more dynamic striker. He's the type of guy that he's going to go and try and sweep the leg in a real fight. You never see that very often, unless you're the Karate Kid. And you look at the Imanari rolls, you look at the crazy ways that he goes for takedowns. He just does, like, he doesn't do rolling thunder, but he'll just do some flips in the cage. He'll do some barrel rolls. He'll just have fun in there. And for Charles Oliveira, a little bit more technical with the way that he goes to take guys down, a little bit more technical with some of that jiu-jitsu, and a guy that still practices in a lot of tournaments as well for his jiu-jitsu.
Oh, yeah, and that is something you do have to bring up, because, again, I feel like this has been a focal point, or at least a talking point, ever since the Thiago Santos-Glover Teixeira fight. And to our credit, we were on this before a lot of people. There's levels to black belts.
A lot of people in the UFC have black belts, but not everyone is Charles Oliveira. And Charles Oliveira, the fact that he does still actively compete in jiu-jitsu inside and outside of the gi, I think that is really important, because at that point, you're not just fighting good MMA grapplers, you're going against those people in their own discipline. And the fact that Charles Oliveira is still having success in straight jiu-jitsu just tells you at what level it must be for MMA fighters who, let's be honest, the average MMA lightweight probably would not be able to enter a lot of those tournaments that Charles Oliveira himself can win. This fight is very odd, because Charles Oliveira does a few things that Tony Ferguson doesn't react to well, and it's the same vice versa. Tony Ferguson applies a ton of pressure. That's the first thing you have to bring up when you talk about Tony Ferguson. Whether he's getting hit, whether he's the one inflicting the damage, it is just in one direction. He's going to be moving forward. Oliveira doesn't react to pressure all that well. Now, he does have a few different attacks and a few different strikes that he likes to use to keep people off him. He's got that really nice kind of jumping push kick that he started using ever since the David Tamer fight, and Dan Hardy brought this up, so full credit to him, but it is true. The David Tamer fight, I really do feel like, was the first time that we saw Charles Oliveira as a possible elite fighter. Now, of course, he is elite at this point, but that was the first fight where, okay, like it was said, he was fighting the Clay Guidas, he was fighting the Jim Millers. Guys were a little bit advanced in their age. I know David Tamer hasn't always won against the top level, but
you better watch your underwears.
You better watch your underwears, because David Tamer is going to do something to him. Shout out to Cody Garbrandt for getting way too mad at that. But anyways, Charles Oliveira, I forget where I was now. I was just, oh, David Tamer. David Tamer is a really good striker, and he's a really well-rounded MMA fighter. And the fact that Charles Oliveira was not only able to go out there and submit him, he beat him up on the feet so bad. He was throwing like Anderson Silva 12-6 elbows. He was throwing jumping front kicks. It was the first time that we had seen that major of an evolution in Oliveira's game, and he hasn't looked back since. He's been able to TKO guys. Now, of course, there's guys being Nick the Carney Lentz and Jared Gordon, who I wouldn't consider elite, but it is a great sign that Oliveira is able to really start hurting guys on the feet. And even in the Kevin Lee fight, yes, Kevin Lee was having success when he took Oliveira down with his ground and pound, but Oliveira on the feet was landing front kicks to the body, really nice combinations over the top. And when Oliveira gets going, he reminds me of a fighter who you wouldn't think of.
Kevin Lee wasn't totally done in that fight.
He was, though. He got choked unconscious. Charles Oliveira... Charles Oliveira, once he gets going, fights like Tim Means. He gets in this like weird rhythm where you can just tell he's confident with letting his hands go. And once he does hit that point, he lands every shot, it seems. His accuracy on the feet, something I don't think he gets enough credit for, but it's something that he's worked on a lot, and you can definitely tell in his fights.
I only have one criticism of you in that analysis. It's the fact that you're too young to use the traditional hourglass or the traditional clock, because it's 6-12 if it goes up like that.
Oh yeah, 12-6, my bad.
I'm just kidding. But overall, in this fight, you have Tony Ferguson that's been at the top of the heap for so long, former interim champ. He brings a baseball with him and bicycle gloves. He just does some weird stuff. And Charles Oliveira that's continued to work on his game to get himself to this point in such a marquee co-main event slot. And we have to say, this was supposed to be Piotr Jan and Aljamain Sterling. Either at the top or in the co-main, flip-flop, whatever you want to do. We're supposed to get a fight like that. This is either a close second or better than that. And I would argue it might even be a little bit better. I'm really looking forward to this fight. So Matt, as far as the stats are concerned, both guys have positive striking differential. Charles Oliveira, a little bit better striking accuracy, a little bit less in terms of striking defense. In terms of the takedown average, Charles Oliveira going for more for 15 minutes at the same accuracy as Tony Ferguson, with slightly less as in terms of takedown defense. But I think that's a product of his game. He averages more submissions per 15 minutes as well. It's been against the lesser competition. So if we have a look at the odds in this one, I have the printed odds. Tony Ferguson opened a minus 130. He's now minus 173. For Charles Oliveira, opened a plus 110, now at a plus 144. Over on Tapology, 893 total votes, 70% going Ferguson, 51% picking him to win by knockout. What do you make of all that?
So, again, I didn't even get to the Tony Ferguson side of what I was going to say. Charles Oliveira doesn't deal with pressure well. What does Tony Ferguson bring when he brings the pressure? Elbows. And those are going to cut Charles Oliveira a lot. Now, Oliveira... It's hard to say this because it's almost a judgment of character, but we've seen him sort of fade in fights when fights get tough. The Paul Felder fight's a great example. He was beating Paul Felder. He was completely out-grappling him. He was doing all those Charles Oliveira things that you expect. And then the second that Paul Felder started to have success, it just felt like Charles Oliveira could never get the reins back. Once the fight gets away from him, he does have a little bit of trouble kind of regaining momentum. And that concerns me against a guy like Tony Ferguson, who we know Tony Ferguson doesn't get tired throwing hundreds of strikes throughout a 5-round fight. Now you're making him fight for 10 minutes less. And the last time we saw Tony Ferguson in a 3-round fight was against Anthony Pettis, or no, Cowboy, I guess, in one of the better fights that you're ever going to see, but also against Anthony Pettis. And I think those two fights are really important because we see an extra aggression to Tony Ferguson, and you're already dealing with one of the more aggressive fighters in all of MMA. So I think that this fight is somewhat tailor-made to Tony Ferguson. I was going back and forth a lot throughout the week. I can see where Charles Oliveira can have success, but when I really ask myself how this fight's going to go, I just see Tony Ferguson throwing a lot of volume up against the cage, and where Justin Gaethje had success was he can counter Tony with power. Oliveira has to counter Tony with almost finesse, and I think that's a very hard thing to do when you're fighting a guy like Al Kakoubi.
So we talked about the Tapology votes. I pulled it up, and I'll have it up on screen as well. Over on the community tab on YouTube, we always post some neat stuff. You can find out the new podcasts that are coming out over on iTunes and Spotify. Maybe we have some t-shirts on sale, fightnightpicks.net. Check them out. Maybe there's some cool Manscaped products, but we threw the vote out there as well. 982 total votes, 71% going with Ferguson, 28% going with Charles Oliveira. It really is a tricky fight to try and break down. You have Tony Ferguson, again, top of the heap for so long, incredibly dynamic with his takedown attempts, with his submission abilities, with his ability on the feet. With Charles Oliveira kind of picking up steam in almost like a Tony Ferguson-esque way.
I agree.
Is it young Ferg? I don't know. In this fight, it's weird because I don't know how much damage Tony Ferguson took in that Justin Gaethje fight. So
a lot.
Exactly. And it was to the point where he's shaking his head, and you never want to see a guy in that type of situation. Like, he had water in his ear. It was terrible. So for Tony Ferguson at 36 years of age, the guy's already a freak athlete as it is. Could I see him pulling out a win? 100% I could. Could I see Charles Oliveira winning this one as well? Yeah, I could. I mean, the odds are what they are. Ferguson almost a 2-1 favorite. I don't really like it where it's at. To me, this is a pass. I will edge Tony Ferguson ever so slightly because, again, I know exactly what he can do, and it hasn't been that long ago since he beat Cerrone and beat Pettis in absolutely grueling fashion to the point where doctor stoppage, corner stoppage, and again, Pettis was hanging in there in that fight, but he also didn't look very good in the face either. And you see those mashups of Tony Ferguson fights after the fact. You know exactly what the guy does. So I will ever so slightly edge Tony Ferguson. And again, we'll see how this one plays out during the week, but I'm really looking forward to it. Final pick?
Tony Ferguson. Again, this is your fight of the night, so it is going to be two-sided. It's not like I think Tony Ferguson is going to run over Charles Oliveira by any means. Just Oliveira, he can't counter Ferguson with the things that we've seen Ferguson struggle with. Ferguson does get hit clean. He does get dropped. But you have to ask yourself, who are the guys doing that? Well, Lando Venata, who definitely isn't on Charles Oliveira's level, but he definitely is a more explosive striker. And Anthony Pettis, who is one of the better strikers really in MMA history. So I think Oliveira can have success. I wouldn't be surprised if he won, but I'm fairly confident with my Ferguson pick.
Matt, really looking forward to this fight. We both have Tony Ferguson to get the win. And hey, you're going to want to stick around for our main event prediction. We have Devastation Figueiredo taking on the assassin baby Brandon Moreno in the main event for flyweight gold. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. Now, Matt, in the words of Mr. Callahan from the movie Tommy Boy, or Tommy himself, the quote is, "You could get a good look at a T-bone by sticking your head up a bull's ass, but wouldn't you sooner take the butcher's word for it?" Matt, we've been calling for Brandon Moreno to get a title shot for a long time. We've also been saying Brandon Moreno flyweight champion by the end of 2020 for a couple of years now. That might seem insane. Take my word for it. You can go back through all of our content, all the content I had on Loudmouth MMA, anywhere you want to find where I've worked. I've said Brandon Moreno future champ by the end of 2020. And yeah, is he ever getting a shot here against Devastation Figueiredo? Matt, this fight is amazing. This fight is very exciting. I was less excited for Devastation Figueiredo when he fought Alex Perez a couple of weeks ago because Brandon Moreno was higher ranked and didn't get the fight. But ultimately, we get it here and now. Two of the best flyweights, two of the most dynamic guys, and two great finishers in this fight. If you sleep on the flyweight division, or if you're not a fan, if you got buddies and pals that aren't fans of flyweight, and you think, hey, if I ran into that guy at a bar, I could beat the shit out of him. Not these two guys. These guys are going to bring it. You want your friends to watch this fight. Matt, I'm really excited about it because normally I don't curse and swear in videos, but it's happening right now. I love this fight stylistically. Overall, just at the start, Give me your excitement level on this fight, and what do you make of it?
I think we need to come clean on something. Brandon Moreno's my joke, and you're Carlos Mencia. I've been on the Brandon Moreno train since his first run in the UFC. I remember him choking out Luis Smolka in his UFC debut. I've been around, okay? And after he came back to the UFC, I was so excited for his fight against Askar Askarov. And you can say what you want about that fight. Did he win? Did he lose? He out-grappled one of the better grapplers in the division, and I think that's the most important point you can take from that fight, no matter what the verdict was. He's fighting not the best flyweight of all time. I almost said it, then I remembered a guy named Demetrius Johnson. I would argue the biggest finishing threat in flyweight history. Fun stat came out. Devison Figueiredo is the only flyweight ever to have 3 knockouts and 3 submission wins. He can get it done in both ways. And I really like the different, I guess, tools of Devison Figueiredo. He's a primary striker. We all know him for that beautiful knockout power that he has. But he has a really advanced and developed defensive submission game, so that when people are tired of dealing with that really nice power striking that he has, if you shoot a lazy takedown, he's going to take your head off. And I don't mean that in a way that he's going to hit you with an uppercut. His guillotine is straight up filthy. It is better than anything for the French Revolution. He goes out there, and the second he clamps that on, you can just tell the fear in a fighter's face. Not everyone has what Joe Rogan calls the squeeze, but Devison Figueiredo has the squeeze, and we've seen it in multiple fights. Again, this is the most exciting fight that can be matched up at flyweight today.
So, Matt, really, I gotta come clean, and you make fun of me on the Mencia thing. I'll tell you why I've been on the Brandon Moreno train. Because Askar Askarov was one of my guys. And again, I talk about it all the time. I've got that board. There's the guys like Pyotrion, Askar Askarov coming over from ACB. There's all sorts of fighters out there. But Askarov, for me, was that guy outside of 125. I think me and Marcel Dorf were the two guys just blowing that horn, just pumping that trumpet. Check out Manscaped. Great stuff. Presenting sponsor. But overall, we were all over Askar Askarov coming into the UFC. And for Brandon Moreno to perform as well as he did in that fight, it won me over so much so that I could tell the guy already has the power, the guy already has the volume, he has the submission abilities, and if he can scramble and tango in there with a guy as credentialed as Askar Askarov, then he really has that sticking power. And then you look at the other wins. Kai Kara-France beats him by decision, beats UCA Formiga, and then finishes Brandon Royval in a weird fight. It was weird the way that it ended, but it was a drubbing by Brandon Moreno in that one up to that point. So, big win for Moreno just a couple of weeks ago to get himself this shot that ultimately he really did deserve. And for Figueiredo, you look at the one loss against Formiga, but then it's wins over Pantoja, Tim Elliott, Joseph Benavidez, Alex Perez. Those are some big names. All some big wins.
Oh, 100%. When Devison Figueiredo fights someone, it's not like the Demetrius Johnson where when he fought, you knew he was going to win and you just kind of, it didn't really matter how he was going to win. You just kind of knew what the outcome was going to be. With Devison Figueiredo, he has a bunch of different options. Now, no, he's not going to German suplex you into an armbar, but I would argue he is the most, he's the best striker in 125 history. I do think he's a better at least striker than Demetrius Johnson was. And I do think the power that Figueiredo has in this weight class is almost unmatched. I would say his power at flyweight is almost equivalent to the power of a Francis at heavyweight. Pound for pound, I do think he's one of the hardest hitters in all of the UFC and really all of MMA in general. Brandon Moreno's an interesting puzzle to solve, if you will, because he can fight very similar to the one guy who has beaten Figueiredo. And that was Jussie Formiga. Now, Moreno and Formiga had a very close fight themselves because they do share a similar style. But what does Brandon Moreno do really well? Well, he throws a very high output. He isn't the most hittable guy because he does kind of, he's known to land and then he'll get out of range, land and get out of range. And he has a really good scrambling and wrestling game. And those are the things that will give Figueiredo problems. I know Tim Elliott has some of those and he got clamped up fairly fast. I know Alex Perez has pretty good scrambles, but that's the foundation of Brandon Moreno's game. It's, I'm going to strike with you, and then I'm going to shoot for a takedown. And I might not get the takedown based on what I was going for, but however you react to defend it, I'm going to go for your back, I'm going to go for a trip. He's really dynamic, and he's always keeping his opponent thinking, which is something I really like for a guy who's almost a 3-1 underdog.
And I mean, in this fight, the one thing that you have to like is the fact that Brandon Moreno, you go from Mexico to Vegas, you stick around, you get your team there. I know he had Luis Smolka in a lot of the promos with Jason House hanging out, wearing his Garfield t-shirt, being a quirky, weird fella that he is. But he seems like a great guy and a great face to have at the top of this flyweight division. And oh, by the way, UFC cut him less than 2 years ago. How crazy is that?
There was no one more upset than me. I don't know how you can cut a fighter. He had a main event against Sergio Pettis, loses to Alejandro Pantoja, no shame in that, one of the more exciting guys at 125, and then they cut him. Now, the great news of Brandon Moreno is life's gotten a lot better since then. The improvements that he has made from his first run in the UFC really are mesmerizing, and the fight in the UFC that he had the most film time, if you will, is that main event against Sergio Pettis, and there were some moments that you really liked that I do think we can sort of compare to the Figueiredo matchup. He had phenomenal grappling, and you could tell that, again, the fight IQ of Brandon Moreno is very high, and it does force his opponent to react to what he's doing constantly, because he is always doing something. Figueiredo, though, he can wait on the counter shot and wait on the counter shot and wait on the counter shot, and I would not be surprised at all if the first round of this fight, Brandon Moreno outstrikes Deiveson Figueiredo, and they're going to pull up a graphic on the screen. They'll be like, wow, he outstruck him like 43-10. The difference, though, is what would you rather do? Get hit by Brandon Moreno 40 times or get hit by Deiveson Figueiredo 10 times? And really cool stat came out. Deiveson Figueiredo almost has a 5% knockdown on strikes thrown in the UFC. That means for every 20 significant strikes, which isn't really that high of a number, he's almost guaranteed one knockdown. So I have to ask myself, can Deiveson Figueiredo land 20 strikes in this fight? Of course he can. He's probably going to land upwards 60, 70, maybe even 80, just depending on how long the fight goes. When you're dealing with those levels of volume against a guy like Moreno, Figueiredo only needs one. So we're giving him a pretty big clip to be firing from with a guy who has so much power.
The weird thing there's a lot of weird things about this fight. The weird thing with Deiveson Figueiredo, I remember going into that first Joseph Benavidez fight. We went back, watched a lot of fight tape on Figueiredo, and picked up on the fact that in the fight against Yusei Formiga, his lone professional loss, because he's 20-1, he missed weight in that fight, and he had to cut so much weight to make that one.
So, yeah, one of my big claims to fame is that I called Figueiredo was going to miss weight for the Benavidez fight, not because he'd ever missed weight before, but it's a fact that has always stuck in my head, and he looked like trash against Formiga. I think it's fair to say we didn't see Deiveson Figueiredo in that fight. We saw a guy who cut 40 pounds. It was 39 to be accurate, but still, when you weigh 125 pounds and you're cutting down from 165, so you're basically a welterweight trying to make the lowest weight class possible, is absolutely insane. And I do like the keywords that have been coming out of Figueiredo's camp ever since he has got the title. It's a lot of, oh, well, I've reinvested a lot of this extra income that I've acquired back into myself. I have better training camps now. I have a nutritionist. I'm able to focus a lot more on myself because I have more resources available to me. I like a lot of those things that we are hearing from Figueiredo's camp. It does concern me a little bit, though, him coming off a weight cut not that long ago. And I do see Figueiredo as a guy who will fight at 135 at some point. I do think either for money fight purposes or just because his body can't make the weight cut anymore, I do think we will see him at bantamweight. He's so heavily muscled for this division. That's something that concerns me. If he does cut a lot of weight, comes into this fight just kind of expecting to knock out Moreno early, and he isn't able to get him out of there early, and it is just Brandon Moreno, pitter-patter, go for a takedown. Maybe I don't get it, but at least I'm putting that in Figueiredo's mind. I think Brandon Moreno can have a lot of long, extended periods where it's like, wow, Brandon Moreno might be the next champ. Problem is, though, Deiveson Figueiredo has what I'm just going to start calling, he has the four-point shot. He has the thing that doesn't even exist. He can be down basically 50-45 and pull a Jairzinho Rozenstruik in the last second of a fight. That's the kind of power that we're dealing with from Deiveson Figueiredo, and we've seen Brandon Moreno struggle with some of those more heavy-handed punchers in the past. Pantoja is a guy who beat him on The Ultimate Fighter, and also once they made it to the UFC. Not to say Pantoja fights in an exact style to Figueiredo, but it's a good comparison because he is a very power-punch-heavy guy at flyweight, and that worries me for Brandon Moreno. I know he's not the most hittable man in the world. Kai Kara France, a guy who's a really good striker, that Brandon Moreno was able to outstrike, but we're dealing with a lot of guys who don't have the pop on their shots like Figueiredo does. And again, it's just really hard to forget about the power advantage that Figueiredo does because it's so monumental between the two.
And the big difference, too, between a guy like Pantoja and a guy like Figueiredo, Pantoja is one of those brooding, brawling type of guys that's just marching forward, throwing the kitchen sink at you. Deiveson Figueiredo, a little bit more precise with his striking. The other thing about Brandon Moreno, the strike differential I don't love. It's slightly positive. It's actually in the negative for Deiveson Figueiredo, if you can believe it. But again, you need a few shots if you're going to land that one power shot, that X factor. Matt, we actually have more votes in Tapology right now in the YouTube community tab with Fight Night Picks. 84% of 1,003 votes going with Deiveson Figueiredo, not Brandon Moreno. Are you surprised there at all?
Not really. Let's be honest. I love Brandon Moreno more than anyone. And I'm going to say, I'm the real conductor of this Brandon Moreno train. You might own the keys to the Pyotr Yan train, the Askar Askarov train. There's a few of them that you've been conducting very well. I've been Brandon Moreno's number one fan for a minute now, and I still don't think he's going to win. It's unfortunate to say, because I know we've been going on Brandon Moreno champ by the end of 2020. It would be really nice if I could come here and say, like, wow, this is actually a stylistic match.
I'm glad I was wrong.
Exactly. But again, you're dealing with Deiveson Figueiredo, who I do believe, if he does have his weight on point, if everything's going right for him, not to say he's a transcendent talent, but I think it's going to be a really hard ask for anyone at flyweight right now to beat him.
I don't know if I'd say transcendent talent just based on the weight class. I would say if Deiveson Figueiredo beats Brandon Moreno here, he is the fighter of the year. I don't think there's even a conversation. There's nobody else close. This guy has won 2020. It's been a tough year for everybody. I know it's been a tough year for everybody, but for Deiveson Figueiredo, the two wins over Benavidez, the knock that he missed weight in the first one, all right, that's fair. But then he finishes him in the second one. He finishes Perez. And if he can get a win over Moreno, even just a win, it's an extra title defense. It's an extra thing to add. And I think that ultimately, Fighter of the Year, Deiveson Figueiredo, and I am ultimately picking him here. I mean, he is a pretty big favorite. Opened at a minus 275. He's now an average minus 327. For Brandon Moreno, open to plus 235, now to plus 255. And I mean, listen, we have more votes in the YouTube community tab, but if you look over on Tapology, 892 total votes, 89% at Figueiredo, 60% happened by knockout.
Again, I can't disagree with any of that. We're probably going to see a Figueiredo finish. It breaks my heart to say, but I do see that as the fight.
Matt, really looking forward to this one. We're both going with Deiveson Figueiredo. And hey, Matt, we have a crazy week. There's a recap show out there from last weekend. There's This Week in MMA coming out. We have two really good guests on that one. We have Early Stoppage, the podcast. You can find all of these picks and predictions on iTunes, Spotify, whatever podcatcher you use. Some great Fight Night Picks merch over the store, fightnightpicks.next. So make sure you check out all that great Fight Night Picks content. We really appreciate all the support that we've had from all you fans this year in 2020. It's really been special to us. We're getting close to 18,000 subscribers, I think, and I hope that we can get up to the 20,000 mark before the end of the year. I know it's possible. I'm really looking forward to the card this weekend, Matt. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it.